language and literature that have shaped our understanding of the atom, transforming unimaginable theories into familiar ideas and pushing the boundaries of our scientific knowledge. Writing the Atom starts Monday morning at 11. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 17th of April. This is Today with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning: the civil servant in charge of the Foreign Office is understood to have been sacked after he cleared Lord Mandelson to become US ambassador, even though he'd failed the security vetting process. Opposition politicians are saying Keir Starmer ought to take responsibility himself and resign. We'll be hearing from the government as well as the leaders of the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. And one other headline: a ceasefire has come into effect between Israel and Lebanon, while President Trump has said Iran is ready to hand over its enriched uranium.
Also in today's programme, Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent, tells us what she's been seeing inside Iran.
Whatever stood here before is completely gone. There's just heaps of concrete and twisted metal. And you can hear the excavator at work and also the workmen carrying away the rubble of this building.
And a new film sees Sir David Attenborough follow the descendants of the Rwandan mountain gorilla Pablo, who he memorably filmed all the way back in 1978. And the family genes appear to be strong.
Not only does he look very similar, he seems to have the same boldness and curiosity.
Before that, the BBC News is read this morning by Chris Aldridge.
The most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, is leaving his job after his department did not inform the Prime Minister that Lord Mandelson had failed security vetting for the post of US ambassador. Downing Street sources say Sir Keir Starmer is furious after only finding out about this on Tuesday. Opposition parties are calling on Sir Keir to resign, saying he misled Parliament when he told the Commons last year that full due process had been followed during Lord Mandelson's appointment. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The downfall of Sir Ollie Robbins was swift. It came after Downing Street said that Lord Mandelson had, last year, failed his in-depth security vetting to be ambassador to Washington, but was appointed anyway as Foreign Office officials overrode the checks. In an extraordinary twist, Number 10 said the Prime Minister had not been aware of any of this until this week. Then, late last night, it was announced Sir Ollie, one of the most high-profile civil servants of the last decade, was leaving. It's understood Sir Keir and the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper had lost confidence in him. Opposition parties were swift to say Sir Keir too should go. The Prime Minister is expected to give a statement on the revelations to the House of Commons on Monday. The BBC understands that Lord Mandelson had no knowledge that he had not passed the vetting approval, and the first he heard of it was yesterday.
A 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon that Hezbollah has indicated it will abide by has come into effect. The truce was brokered by the United States after 6 weeks of fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed group. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Hezbollah continued to fire rockets at northern Israel until just before midnight local time, when the ceasefire came into effect. Israeli shelling of Lebanese villages is said to have continued for half an hour afterwards. But the hope is that this truce brokered by Washington will advance a peace deal between Israel and Lebanon, which have no diplomatic relations. President Trump has invited their leaders to the White House for what he described as the first meaningful talks between the two countries in over 40 years. However, Israel is insisting its forces will not withdraw from southern Lebanon, where the Prime Minister said it's creating what he called a security zone 6 miles from the border. Hezbollah has indicated that it will stick to the ceasefire, but has also said that Israel's ongoing occupation grants the Lebanese the right to resist, a position which could cause complications.
President Trump says Iran has agreed to hand over its enriched uranium, one of the key sticking points in negotiations to bring the war to an end. Fresh talks, he said, could resume as early as this weekend, with Washington and Tehran very close to making a deal. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Speaking at an event in Las Vegas focusing on the US economy, Donald Trump gave one of his most upbeat assessments of the war since it started. He said it was going swimmingly and should be ending soon. Earlier at the White House, he said Iran had agreed not to obtain a nuclear weapon and would turn over what he called the nuclear dust, enriched uranium, believed to be buried underground following the US-Israeli airstrikes last year. Iran has not commented on the president's claim. Apparently confident that a fresh round of face-to-face talks is imminent, Mr. Trump said he wasn't sure an extension to the ceasefire with Iran, which is due to expire in 5 days, was necessary.
France and the UK are to chair a meeting in Paris aimed at establishing a multinational force to ensure safe passage for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. 40 leaders are expected to take part in the discussions, either in person or by video link. The US, Iran and Israel won't be involved. Officials have said any operation would start once the war had ended. The cost of living has been blamed in part for a big rise in uninsured drivers on the UK's roads. Last year, there were nearly 160,000 cases, an increase of 20% in the past 5 years, and the highest total since 2009. Our Midlands correspondent Phil Mackey sent this report from one of the worst affected areas.
In Birmingham, another car's been spotted with an uninsured driver at the wheel. His vehicle, an old Toyota, was seized. He'll also be fined £300 and get 6 points on his licence. The Motor Insurers Bureau says many people who are stopped say they simply can't afford the cost of insurance. Others try to cheat the system by paying for cheaper policies than they really need, while criminals either hide behind fake IDs or don't bother paying for insurance at all. The irony is that accidents caused by those without proper cover means the cost of insurance gets even higher. Despite the increase in seizures, it's believed around 300,000 uninsured or incorrectly insured drivers take to the UK's roads every day.
Specialist shops selling Pokemon cards have been targeted in a series of robberies across the UK. High-profile sales, driven by investors and collectors, have been noticed by criminals, as Felicity Hannah reports.
Pokemon have been collected, played with and traded for 30 years. But the colourful Japanese cards depicting pocket monsters or Pokemon have recently rocketed in value. Since the COVID pandemic, they've attracted more online attention as influencers have published videos unboxing them and showing off their rarest cards. Earlier this year, the YouTuber and wrestler Logan Paul auctioned an ultra-rare, very high-quality Pikachu card for a record-shattering $16.5 million, around £12 million. As the value has risen, so has the number of thefts. In recent weeks, small businesses in Rugby, Bristol, Bournemouth, Warrington, Peterborough and Nottingham have been targeted.
Felicity Hannah reporting.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six is the time. Let us have our first look at the weather. It comes from Sarah Keith Lucas at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Justin. Well, we're in for a cloudy, breezy sort of day today. There'll be outbreaks of rain for some of us, particularly in the north and the west. But as a weather front tracks its way southwards and eastwards today, I think we'll all see a little bit of wet weather by the end of the day. Now, for southeast England, eastern England and the East Midlands, you're going to be staying dry for a good part of the day and there should be some decent spells of sunshine developing. A little bit of a breeze here and there, but top temperatures 17 or 18 degrees. So a pleasant enough day here. There will be some rain eventually, but that'll arrive by the evening hours. For southwest England, into Wales, the West Midlands, as well as all of northern England, most places are starting dry, but there's already some rain in the west, and that area of rain is going to track eastwards across the region through the day. It's also going to be quite windy, but we should see a return to sunny skies as we head through the latter part of the afternoon, and top temperatures will be around 15 or 16 degrees. For Scotland and Northern Ireland then, we've got the front that's bringing rain, particularly across the western half of Scotland, some showers across Northern Ireland. As that front tracks its way eastwards, we'll all be seeing a return to sunshine and showers as we head through the middle part of the day. It is going to be windy with gusts of wind around 50 miles an hour in the far northwest and top temperatures around 14 or 15 degrees here. As we head through tonight then, the rain should clear away for most of us to the south and east. Still a few showers in the north overnight, but the weekend, a lot of dry and settled weather as high pressure builds. Some scattered showers, especially in the north and west on Saturday, but more of us are going to see drier and sunnier conditions by Sunday.
Thank you, Sarah. 9 minutes past six. Now let's take a look through the front pages of the morning papers. Sir Keir Starmer and Lord Mandelson appear on most of them. However, they were published before it emerged that Sir Ollie Robbins was leaving his job. So with that in mind, the Daily Telegraph reports that staff at Number 10 believe that they were lied to by the Foreign Office about the fact that Lord Mandelson had failed his enhanced security vetting. According to the I paper this morning, the Prime Minister only found out as officials were compiling documents to release to Parliament. Someone close to Sir Keir Starmer tells the Financial Times it is inconceivable that he would have gone ahead with the appointment had he known.
The Daily Express leads on the calls by opposition parties for the Prime Minister to quit over claims that he misled Parliament when he said all due process had been followed. The Guardian, whose reporting broke the story, says Sir Keir Starmer will also be pressed about misleading the public. The paper's among several to highlight that he told journalists in February that the security vetting process had cleared Lord Mandelson for the role, a statement that contradicts the application's outcome, The Guardian says.
The Daily Mail says the pushback by Downing Street amounts to a last-ditch effort to keep Sir Keir in his job. On the topic of a leadership challenge, a source involved in previous moves against the Prime Minister has told The Times it's on. The leader column in the Daily Telegraph says that questions around Sir Keir Starmer's future had looked to have been postponed until after the May elections, but the paper says he may have that luxury no longer.
The Daily Mirror chooses to lead instead on Vladimir Putin, saying the Russian leader has drawn up a list of four locations in the UK that he could target for backing Ukraine's war effort. Production sites in 11 other European countries also mentioned in a statement from the Russian Ministry of Defence. The Mirror's main editorial says this is intimidation, pure and simple, and the UK should not flinch now.
It is 10 past six.
Now, Keir Starmer is meant to be in Paris today for a meeting focusing on reopening the Strait of Hormuz. James Waters, our Paris correspondent. What are we expecting to come of this meeting, James? Who's involved?
Well, we're told 40 participants, including the UK, France, countries from Southeast Asia, the Middle East. And what organisers are very keen to stress, Justin, is that this is not a contribution to a war they see, most participants see, as lacking a legal basis. What this seems to be more of is a political proposition to split the difference between Iran controlling the Strait of Hormuz, as it has done by targeting commercial vessels with drone strikes, but also America's blockade in response as it looks to restrict Iran's ability to export oil. We are not going to see European vessels, it seems, making their way to the region to try and police a waterway. This is a proposition for when the war ends. It has echoes of the so-called coalition of the willing with Ukraine. It's about Europe trying to insert itself into the political conversation. So the ideas include military escorts, demining, the sharing of intelligence to primarily restore confidence to oil shipping companies and their insurers, as well as try and ease the global market.
Do we know if they're actually in touch with the Iranians?
There were reports last week that the regime in Tehran had been briefing some European governments, including Germany and France. I don't think you can rule it out, certainly. It seems this is quite a bridging operation politically, where they are looking to find an agreement where the Iranians would agree to de-escalate on the Strait of Hormuz, but crucially the Americans would look to open the waterway as well. I think that is certainly the tone looking to be struck in the French capital this morning.
James Waterhouse in Paris. Thank you.
12 minutes past six, a 10-day ceasefire has begun in Lebanon overnight, though Israel has said that its forces will remain in the area in the south of the country, which they are occupying. Hugo Bashega, our Middle East correspondent, is in Beirut. And Hugo, that is one of the reasons why this ceasefire is quite a tricky proposition.
Yeah, Erna, and it remains a very complicated situation. So Hezbollah is indicating that it will abide by the ceasefire. Obviously, its supporters have been suffering because of this war. But at the end of the day, Hezbollah is keeping its weapons. Invading Israeli troops remain inside Lebanese territory. And Israel, according to the deal, may even continue to attack Lebanon. So this gives you an idea of how difficult the situation is. So the Lebanese are exhausted, desperate for some respite. But this may be a pause and not the end of the conflict here. Now, obviously, the ceasefire is being celebrated. We've seen some scenes of celebration here in Beirut, also in the south of the country. But parts of this country have been devastated. More than 2,100 people have been killed. Over 1 million people have been displaced. And because of this occupation of parts of the south, some of these families may not be able to go back home for now.
And as you say, Hugo, 10 days is not long to sort this out. What potential routes are there that could be taken to try and find a solution?
Yeah, this is, you know, one of the key questions here, because one of the roots of this conflict is Hezbollah's arsenal. And this is an issue that has long divided the Lebanese. Opponents say Hezbollah defends the interests of Iran. Obviously, Iran has funded, trained, armed Hezbollah. They say that Hezbollah has dragged Lebanon into these devastating wars and that it must be disarmed. Now, supporters say Hezbollah is the only force capable of protecting them, that this is a state that is unable to defend Lebanese land. So it is a very difficult situation. And for days we've been discussing this here. You know, the government cannot deliver Hezbollah's disarmament. The president here has been saying that this has to be a negotiated process, that there must be a deal with Hezbollah, that the government is not going to deploy Lebanese soldiers to seize Hezbollah's weapons. And for now, Hezbollah has rejected any discussions, any process to discuss the future of its weapons. So it is a very difficult situation for the government here.
Hugo Bishega in Beirut, thank you.
It is 6:15. The boss of the UK's biggest supermarket says he doesn't recognise warnings that food inflation could reach double digits by the end of the year. There is no doubt, of course, that there is inflation caused by the war. How bad is it going to be? Felicity Hannah has more on that and the rest of the day's business news. Morning, Felicity.
Morning, yes. So the Tesco CEO, Ken Murphy, says the business is in good shape, despite concerns that the conflict with Iran could squeeze food supplies and add to costs. And this comes after the Food and Drink Federation told the BBC earlier this month that it's forecasting food inflation to reach at least 9% by December, and that it could go into double digits if the conflict continues. Let's talk to Jonathan Lawson, who's chief executive of Buckham Group, which runs more than 120 pubs from London to the Channel Islands, as well as a brewery in Bristol. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
You serve food in your pubs. What are you seeing?
We're seeing at the moment, we've just kicked off our new financial year, relatively moderate and stable levels of food inflation within our supply chain and our business. We are clearly watching that very carefully. I would agree that the numbers around double-digit inflation, I think, are slightly on the negative side, and it's far too early to tell at the moment. What we are more concerned about is the medium to long-term impact on food inflation, particularly linked to issues around fertilizer cost and availability. People have rightly and understandably been very focused on the impact of oil and fuel supply through the Straits of Hormuz. But the components of fertilizer is significantly impacted by that. And that will affect arable crops and also meat producers later in the year and then into the following year as well. So it is very much a watching brief at the moment, but certainly we are not seeing issues on supply at the moment or high levels of inflation.
But you are worried it might have a long tail for your business. I mean, a government source told the BBC that it was planning for a scenario that would involve the continued closure of the Strait of Hormuz and potentially breakdowns in the supply of carbon dioxide. Now, that's used in all sorts of different food production ways, including keeping fresh meat produce fresh. What would that mean for your brewery, though?
Well, right. CO2 has various uses within both our food and drink supply chain. In food, we are less directly affected, particularly around our meat supplies, locally supplied, reared and slaughtered, and doesn't involve CO2. It clearly has an impact on drinks, both in our brewery process and also in the storage capability and capacity of our pubs. We are not seeing an immediate concern with that, and neither at the moment is our overall sector. However, storage capability of CO2 is limited in a business such as ours. So this can move from not being a problem to becoming a problem very quickly, i.e. in a matter of weeks. So we are keeping, again, a very close watching brief on that, because it would become a problem relatively quickly, and our ability to resolve that is limited.
What does that uncertainty mean then for a business like yours in terms of the forward planning you're making, thinking about investment, thinking about hiring?
Well, I think this year was to an extent quite difficult for us to plan already. We had a very good year last year, both from a sales and a growth point of view, and we invested significantly into our business. But as I've said on a number of occasions, the rising cost and tax base that this government and previous governments have inflicted on business and on our sector in particular make it very difficult for us to have confidence around investment and employment growth. And the latest increases on NMW have added to that. So we are always optimistic, but I think the government's narrative at the moment, that the latest GDP figures are showing signs that they're doing a good job, I would challenge that.
NMW, of course, National Minimum Wage. But a lot of people listening to you would say, well, hang on a minute. Pubs got a 15% cut to new business rates bills from April, followed by a two-year real terms freeze. And there's going to be a review into the method that's used to value them for business rates. So the government is listening to your concerns.
Yeah, the government's not listening. We need to be very clear about this. The government and the Chancellor promised to reform business rates for our sector and retail in the October budget of 2024. They have still yet to deliver on their promise. And to put that into context, the further measures that they announced for this year will, against our original assumptions, will save us about £150,000. To put that in context, the increase to national insurance contributions and national minimum wage last year cost us over £2 million. And that national minimum wage for 18 to 20 to 20-year-olds has just gone up by a further 8.5%. So they have made a big deal out of what in context is a small amount of money for our business.
Jonathan Lawson, Chief Executive of Butcombe Group, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, let's stick with the fallout from the conflict that we're seeing in the Middle East. A lot of people are finding it very painful to fill up their cars at the moment. It is even more painful for airlines. EasyJet has said it expects a first half headline loss before tax of between £540 million and £560 million. It's issued a trading update that says demand is holding up from customers, but that's been outweighed by about £25 million of extra fuel costs in March. That is on top of a lawsuit and the cost of expansion in Italy. Let's talk to Lucy Coutts, Investment Director and Head of JM Finn's York office. Lucy, morning. This update spooked more than EasyJet investors, didn't it? The front page of the Times business pages this morning says Europe's biggest airlines fell by $3 billion on Thursday.
Yes, I mean, these results are the sort of first out of the traps. And I mean, I think, you know, we should still focus in the longer term that EasyJet is still growing. It's still got a very strong balance sheet. Its holidays part of the business is growing. But the thing that investors are focused on is that it's, the numbers have been squeezed by higher oil and jet fuel costs. They're hoping to keep cancellations low, and they're very reliant on hedging, which they've done their fuel costs into 2027 rather than cutting capacity. But one point that the CEO did make is that, you know, when he was sort of questioned, is that, you know, airlines only ever have 3 to 4 weeks visibility of jet fuel supplies. But obviously, it's much more sensitive given the conflict in the Middle East.
Let's talk about Netflix, because their shares fell in after-hours trading after the company gave weaker-than-expected profit forecasts for the current quarter. They also said that the co-founder and chairman of Netflix, Reed Hastings, is stepping down from the board after 29 years. But Lucy, first quarter numbers were beaten. Revenue rose 16%. Why were investors a bit worried?
It's on the back of Reed Hastings stepping down. And I think this is a very sort of short-term reaction, because Netflix has a wonderful business model. You know, it's subscription revenues that's growing. Revenue actually, and they expect it to grow 12 to 14% a year, which is a great business model. But this news comes on the back of it walking away from acquiring Warner Brothers, you know. It was always nice to have, not a need to have. That was made clear. But, you know, there was a battle to win that prize, Warner Brothers. And then guidance is just lower for Q2. But, again, looking at the sort of more positive, they are reiterating their full-year forecast. So it's just a little bit of a bump in the road, but I think it's more emotional sentiment to Reed Hastings stepping down.
Lucy Coutts from JM Finn, thank you very much indeed. Now, the government has launched what it has named its Sovereign AI Unit, a venture capital fund that will invest in British AI companies. It's backed by £500 million of government funding, and the idea is to support AI businesses here in the UK in the hopes of developing them into world leaders. It will be chaired by James Wise. He's a partner at the venture fund Balderton Capital, and he joins me now. James, good morning.
Good morning.
So what does this actually mean for UK businesses, and how will you decide which will get priority?
Well, we believe sort of AI is going to be the most important technology of our lifetimes. As the global AI economy grows, we want to make sure the UK and British businesses get a bigger share of it. It means we'll be directly investing in some of our breakout AI companies, specifically in those serving critical areas of the infrastructure around AI. So that's things like chips, models, and large GDP-moving applications of AI. And we're also going to be investing in commercial successes, so not just research and grant into academic work, actual businesses.
Now, we hear about AI progress every day, don't we? You're saying it's the most important technology of our lifetimes, but we're not the only country in the world that can spot that. The US in particular has seen a huge amount of development there. Is the UK slightly late to the party launching this fund now?
I mean, overall, we're in a really good place. UK AI companies announced £6 billion of investment over the last 3 months, and every major AI lab in the world has opened or expanded their offices in the UK over the last couple of years. I think if you look at it, we are the first port of call for 90% of the AI labs in the world as they go to a new country. So we're in a great place already. We're building on our heritage with Arm and DeepMind, and we hope Sovereign AI will play a small role in accelerating that further.
You've said, you tweeted, in fact, on X, that data sets will be open sourced. The default will always be to make data as open and freely available as possible. Does that mean that you're sort of handing information, making information available to all countries, taking British data and giving it to the world for free? Is that very sovereign?
Well, the UK has always contributed to global research. It's one of the great strengths we have here through our universities and also government work. We've had breakthroughs like OpenBind, which we worked on at the UK within DSIT, within the UK's Sovereign AI Unit already. Obviously, we'll be investing in British companies and working with British companies to understand the data they need to be successful, and that gives them a huge advantage.
We heard this week finance ministers, central bankers, financiers, they're expressing real concerns about the powerful new AI model Claude Mythos by Anthropic. It's found vulnerabilities in every major operating system and browser. Are you concerned? AI is obviously going to present opportunities for business, but also real dangers.
Well, we're very fortunate in the UK to have the AI Safety Institute, who did a huge amount of work with Anthropic to really understand Mythos. And it's the first of what will be many more powerful models that, you're right, can expose these vulnerabilities. At the Sovereign AI Unit, we're investing in British AI companies that are tackling that, companies working in AI security and safety. And we hope the models that expose vulnerabilities are also the models which will fix them.
Well, we hope that you'll come back and tell us how the investment is going. James Wise, partner at the venture fund Balderton Capital and the new chairman of the Sovereign AI Unit. Thank you very much indeed.
Felicity, thank you. 27 minutes past six to the sport. Here's Mike.
Hello, Justin. If anybody is still a bit bleary-eyed this morning, this should wake you up.
Gibbs White again. Shoots to
flip. Yes!
Forrester are in front.
Get in there!
It's Morgan Gibbs White and it flies into the Porto net. Forest go in front, they lead 2-1 on aggregate in the Europa League quarter-final.
Yes, a 1-0 win on the night over FC Porto meant it was an historic evening on the banks of the River Trent for Nottingham Forest.
The referee's blown his whistle and Forest, for the first time in 42 years, will contest a major European semi-final.
Yes, Forest rolling back the years. They are through to a first European semi-final since 1982. Paul McCartney was number one with Ebony and Ivory when they were last at this stage in a European competition. Now, Forest's European journey to the last four has taken them this season to Spain, Denmark, Portugal, Austria, Turkey. For the semi-final, they will have to travel all the way to Birmingham, because Forest will play Aston Villa in the semi-finals after a very one-sided victory for them last night.
and it is turned home by Esri Konsa. Villa romping clear to 4-0 on the night, 7-1 on aggregate.
Yes, the England internationals, Ollie Watkins, Morgan Rogers and Esri Konsa all amongst the goals as Unai Emery's Aston Villa dispatched Bologna 4-0 on the night at Villa Park.
The performance collectively and playing two matches, I think is really fantastic, but difficult. Of course, we beat them and we have won this match clearly with the result, but because we played serious match.
So Nottingham Forest against Aston Villa, the first leg at the City Ground in a couple of weeks' time. A big battle of Britain in the semi-finals of the Europa League. Meanwhile, Crystal Palace are through to the Europa Conference League last four, where they will meet Shakhtar Donetsk. It's despite a narrow 2-1 defeat to Fiorentina last night. They won the tie 4-2 on aggregate. Here's their manager, Oliver Glasner.
Just delighted to get through, and we expected Fiorentina trying everything, and this is what they did. I think we had a great start into the game. We defended very well, didn't give them a big chance after they took the lead. And over the two legs, I think we deserved to qualify for the semi-final.
Meanwhile, the champagne's still on ice in Bromley. A win last night will have seen Bromley promoted to League One, but the League Two leaders have to wait a little longer for that promotion party after a goalless draw with Cambridge. And just briefly away from football in golf, the LIV Golf chief executive Scott O'Neill has told players that the 2026 season will continue as planned and uninterrupted amid rumours that the tour is on the verge of collapse. The Financial Times reported this week that Saudi Arabia's public investment fund is set to end its support for the breakaway tour, which would jeopardise its future. But O'Neill says it is business as usual for now. We will have more on this story in the next hour of the programme.
Thank you, Mike. This weekend, here on Radio 4, a spy thriller awaits.
Drama in World War II.
Ah, Miss Armstrong, good evening.
And 10 years later...
It's Juliet. Juliet Armstrong.
Forgive me, Miss Armstrong. You have me mixed up with someone else.
Juliet Armstrong, a former spy, haunted by her work.
Should I run after him? And say what? Where have you been? And why on earth are you denying all knowledge of me when together we committed a most hideous act?
Phoebe Price and Toby Jones star in Transcription by Kate Atkinson. Starting on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Time now, 29 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster, Justin Webb and Chris Aldridge with a summary of the news.
The most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office is leaving his job after it emerged the department overruled a failed security check on Lord Mandelson during the process to appoint him as US ambassador. The Prime Minister is understood to have lost confidence in Sir Ollie Robbins. Opposition parties are calling on Sir Keir to resign, saying he misled Parliament when he told the Commons last year that full due process had been followed during Lord Mandelson's appointment. A 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon has come into effect. The truce brokered by the US could help negotiations to end the war with Iran. The Iranian-backed group Hezbollah has indicated that it will abide by the deal. President Trump has given an upbeat assessment of the prospect for peace with Iran, saying the US was very close to making a deal to end the war. He said that Iran had agreed to hand over its enriched uranium. France and the UK are to chair a meeting in Paris aimed at establishing a multinational force to ensure safe passage for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. 40 leaders are expected to take part in the discussions, either in person or by video link. The US, Iran and Israel won't be involved. The cost of living has been blamed partly for a big rise in uninsured drivers on the UK's roads. Last year, there were nearly 160,000 cases, an increase of 20% in the past 5 years, and the highest total since 2009. The Motor Insurers Bureau says many people who have stopped say they simply can't afford to pay for insurance. The four Artemis II astronauts have said their mission gave the world a sense of hope and unity at a time when both feel in short supply. The crew spent 10 days in space, the first time humans have ventured near the moon in more than half a century.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to 7 is the time. Keir Starmer is once again in deep political water following The Guardian's bombshell report that Peter Mandelson failed his vetting process before he was appointed ambassador to the US, but was appointed anyway. Let's talk to Harry Farley, our political correspondent, who's in Downing Street for us. this morning. And the overnight news, Harry, is that Ollie Robbins is going, effectively has been sacked, we assume.
Yes, that's right. Ollie Robbins, the most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, effectively being blamed by Downing Street for the fact that the Prime Minister, they say, Downing Street says, did not know that Lord Mandelson had failed his security vetting, his in-depth vetting process before being appointed Lord Mandelson, did not know that until Tuesday of this week. And there's sort of sheer incredulity across government and across Labour backbenchers from those I was speaking to last night about that fact. I'm told that the Prime Minister spoke to Ollie Robbins last night, and after that we were told that both he and the Foreign Secretary had lost confidence in him, and as a result he will be leaving that job. As to that, as to what happens next, well, those vetting documents will now be passed, I'm told, to that committee of MPs that is overseeing the process for the publication of all those documents relating to Lord Mandelson's appointment. Those documents around Lord Mandelson's vetting and why he failed it will be published, I'm told, as soon as possible, but no immediate time frame of when that might be.
And of course the big problem for Sir Keir is that inadvertently, he would say, but one way or the other, he has misled the public, certainly, because there's no question that he suggested to the public, didn't he, at a press conference, that the vetting had been passed, but also potentially the Commons, which is a serious thing.
A very serious thing, and a resignation matter under the ministerial code. You're right. So at a press conference, he said quite explicitly that Lord Mandelson had passed his security vetting, when now we know he hadn't. And in the Commons, repeatedly, he said that full due process was followed. And I suppose that is the key question as to whether Lord Mandelson failing his security vetting amounted to full due process. There is certainly pressure, not just from opposition parties calling for the Prime Minister to resign, but also real anger from Labour MPs I was speaking to last night. One said, it doesn't look good, and then in slightly fruitier language said, something smells somewhere, the country is done with that. And another said, the explanation being put forward stretches credibility to almost breaking point. And they will go on to say that if this was the other side of the elections, those crucial set of elections, it would be terminal, and it could still be now. And I think that's the key point, that we are now less than 3 weeks away from those really important set of elections in Scotland, Wales and English local councils, and that may well dampen any sort of anger boiling over on the Labour backbenches to a call for an immediate resignation. But certainly that anger is there, and it risks for the Prime Minister boiling over.
And we'll be talking to the Prime Minister's Chief Secretary at 8:10, and indeed to opposition leaders throughout the programme as well. Harry Farley, for the time being, thank you.
24 minutes to 7 now. Last night, the leaders of the six biggest political parties vying for power in Wales lined up for a debate hosted by the BBC's Question Time programme in Cardiff. Here is a flavour of what each party had to offer. Welsh Labour's Hugh Iranca-Davies highlighted what he argued was a good track record in managing government budgets.
We have lived through 14 years of Tory cuts to Welsh Government budgets, and we have managed those budgets and done our darndest to protect frontline services, invest in health, invest in social care. So within our offers, they are well-costed, well-funded, we know where the money is.
The Wales Green Party's Anthony Slaughter said they would make sure the wealthiest in society pay more.
The UK is a wealthy nation. There is wealth in these countries. Those people aren't paying their tax. That's why, at a larger UK level, we talk about wealth taxes, making the millionaires and the billionaires pay their fair share to fix our broken services that they all rely on.
Welsh Liberal Democrat Jane Dodds focused on improving social care.
We need to put more money into social care to help our NHS. And to do that, we want the money to come from Westminster or the Senate budget. But if it can't, we'll be really upfront with Welsh people and we'll say we want a penny on income tax, ring fence for social care to fix the crisis.
Welsh Conservative Darren Millar promised to stop the government from wasting taxpayers' money.
We want to roll back the size of the Welsh Government civil service. You know, we're all paying an extra £160 million each and every year compared to what we were paying just 3 years ago for the size of the Welsh Government. That's too much bureaucracy and we need to get rid of it.
Reform UK Wales's Dan Thomas also made a case for cutting bureaucracy to help fund tax cuts.
We have 200 quangos in Wales, well over 200 quangos, costing us over £135 million. Again, we need to merge those, bring them in-house, need to change that. We're over-governed.
And Plaid Cymru's Rhun ap Iorwerth made the case for fairer funding for Wales.
We still need UK government to play its part in giving us fair funding for Wales, giving us the £4 billion owed to us because of HS2 Rail, allowing us to take control of our own natural resources in Wales through giving us control of the Crown Estate.
Well, Thomas Morgan is our Wales correspondent and was watching that. Thomas, a flavour there of what they had to say. What were the main takeaways from that debate?
Well, there was a couple of big clashes, I guess, throughout the programme. Nothing kind of main standout. I think all the parties, now that they've all given out their manifestos, that did come under scrutiny to begin, really. Had they really put realistic figures for some of their promises, or had they not put any at all, actually, in some cases? Rhina Bjorweth from Plaid did come under some scrutiny at one stage. He had to deny that his party would restrict a £1,000 grant currently paying to all students, university students, to those paying in Wales. That was a policy announced just last year by a future government for them. The heated exchange between Jane Dodds of the Welsh Lib Dems and Dan Thomas on the 20 miles per hour restriction in Wales, which has been obviously so much talked about, really. Jane Dodds wanted to keep it, Dan Thomas obviously wanted to get rid of it. But really, of all the three questions, the three main questions asked by the audience, the most lively response really came around the NHS. And the NHS, the health service in Wales, struggling for years. And it is quite clear, really, when you speak to people in Wales and from the polling done here, really, that is the area that the people in Wales want to see a change from the next Welsh Government. They want to see a substantial difference, really. So on that, there were a couple of clashes, really. Labour, who have been in power for the best part of 27 years in some form or another, really. Hugh Rancus Davies, they really had to defend the way that the Labour government over the years has been dealing with health, really, and said that he had been putting pressure on health bosses over waiting times because it was their jobs to bring those times down. Reforms, Dan Thomas said the NHS in Wales had to be streamlined as part of their long-term reform. Plaid Cymru's Rhina Bjorweth said the dilapidation of hospitals had happened under that Labour time period. Anthony Slaughter of the Green Party called for an end of corridor care initially by stopping reducing of beds. The Welsh Lib Dems' Jane Dodd said social care had to be fixed, you heard in that clip, by potentially putting 1p on every part of income tax. And Darren Millar, the Conservative, said it was a disgrace that people in Wales couldn't get a GP appointment or see a dentist at the moment.
Thomas Morgan, our Wales correspondent, thank you.
19 minutes to 7 is the time. Is the new ceasefire in Lebanon, which was meant to begin overnight, actually holding? President Trump has made it clear that he wanted Israel to agree to it. Let's talk to Yolande Nell, our Middle East correspondent, joins us now from Jerusalem. There have been breaches, haven't there, Yolande? There's no doubt about that.
Indeed. And, you know, Hezbollah has continued with its rocket fire until just before midnight, with a number of injuries reported in northern Israel. And then there was reports of shelling by the Israeli military on some villages close to the border, a reminder that Israeli forces remain on the ground there. The Israeli military has said it's looking into those reports. But still, you know, shaky as it may be, this 10-day ceasefire is an opportunity to end 6 weeks of this fierce fighting that has gone on between Israel and Hezbollah. This deal announced by President Trump is also, for him, of course, removing an obstacle in his efforts to extend the ceasefire to end the war between Iran and the US and Israel. So this was, you know, really brokered by the US, a flurry of diplomacy by them going between, first of all, the Israel and Lebanese ambassadors, and then calling Benjamin Netanyahu and Lebanese President Joseph Aoun to get their agreement to this plan that's been drawn up by the State Department. There are some notable points in it where Israel reserves the right to defend itself. It's just told to stop offensive operations. The indications are that Hezbollah will stick to this ceasefire. It's basically crediting Iran for brokering it, but it's also said in one of its statements that Israel's ongoing occupation of southern Israel gives the right to Lebanese people to resist. So, of course, that is a remaining issue.
And I suppose one of the questions is whether Iran can carry on funding Hezbollah, given the pressure the Iranian regime itself is under.
Indeed. And, you know, that's been one of the key demands of Israel, that Iran must stop funding its proxies around the region. And key among those has been Hezbollah. There have been rounds and rounds of conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. There was this ceasefire agreement back in late 2024, which was supposed to see the disarmament of Hezbollah. It's now going to be a challenge for the Lebanese government in the coming days to take real steps to try to sort of, you know, de-weaponize this powerful armed group. It's also a political player in Lebanon.
Yelena, thank you very much. We'll be coming back to this at about 7:15.
17 minutes to 7 now. There was a mixed reaction yesterday in Parliament to the news that more businesses are to get help with their energy bills as part of a scheme for manufacturing firms. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
The Prime Minister has repeatedly told the Commons that the UK will stay out of the war in Iran. And this week, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, spoke of her anger and frustration at the US decision to go to war. But none of that has insulated British firms from the price hikes in oil and gas. And so the Business Secretary, Peter Kyle, announced that the British Industrial Competitiveness Scheme, originally set up to help 7,000 companies, would now support 10,000 firms.
They will be exempt from paying the indirect costs of three other schemes: the renewables obligation, feed-in tariffs, and the capacity market. BICS is designed to support eligible businesses across all regions of Great Britain. The eligible sectors collectively employ 900,000 people, of which 700,000 of them live outside of London and the South East.
The lifting of those green levies on companies in the car manufacturing, aerospace and defence sectors means firms could see their bills cut by up to 25%. The scheme will start next April, but eligible businesses will get a one-off payment backdated to this month. Some business groups have complained that the scheme doesn't go far enough, criticisms echoed by a Conservative shadow business minister, Gareth Davis.
According to the government's figures, at least 99% of companies will not benefit under the scheme, even after the announced expansion. Pubs, restaurants, farmers, retailers are all also facing energy cost challenges. And innovative companies like OpenAI have halted planned multi-billion pound investments in our country. So can I ask what action the government will be taking to address those businesses' concerns?
Peter Kyle said it was a targeted scheme rather than something for the entire economy. But the deputy leader of the Lib Dems, Daisy Cooper, said the UK was in a very fragile state.
We cannot defend ourselves, we cannot feed ourselves, and we cannot power ourselves. Our national security, our food security, and our energy security are deeply interconnected. And the government's response is far too sluggish. The CBI and others are very, very clear. Their response to this announcement is that industry cannot wait until next year. A back payment in 12 months will not cut it.
She feared firms would close and jobs would be lost. And the business secretary had failed to win over Richard Tice of Reform UK.
Well, is that it, Secretary of State? 5 months it's taken for the Secretary of State to come up with an energy price scheme that he has admitted here in the House today only supports 10,000 businesses. He seems to forget there are millions of small businesses up and down the country, whether it's restaurants, whether it's fish and chip shops, whether it's pubs, whether it's ceramics, whether it's farmers.
The SNP's Dave Dugan was similarly underwhelmed.
What we were promised was a statement on the British Industrial Competitive Scheme. What we got was the Secretary of State talking about footering around with the energy bills of less than 1% of UK companies and compensating them to some extent, undetermined, at some period in the next year.
The minister said the scheme was aimed at manufacturing rather than for every business in all circumstances. But Labour's Gareth Snell, one of the MPs who represents Stoke-on-Trent, known as the Potteries, complained that there was no help for the ceramics industry.
Nothing for tableware or giftware, nothing for ceramic tiles, clay pipes or clay tiles. Nothing for bricks, Madam Deputy Speaker, with a government that hasn't objected to build 1.5 million homes. No support for bricks in this strategy, meaning we're going to have to import bricks from Pakistan on diesel-chugging super tankers, whether they've been made by indentured labour in coal-fired kilns, and we won't make them in Warsaw or North Staffordshire.
Peter Kyle said he'd just discovered that no business secretary had been to Stoke to meet the ceramics industry for over 5 years. He said he was willing to go to the Potteries to meet the companies if that was something they wanted.
As Sean Curran reporting, it's 12 minutes to 7. Significant news for the climate, the vital Atlantic current system, the thing that brings warm tropical water to raise the temperatures around Europe, appears significantly more likely to fall apart than scientists previously thought. Tom Rivett-Carnac is with us, former political strategist for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, now the co-host of the Outrage and Optimism podcast. Good morning.
Good morning.
I will wager that this is one of those things that has probably passed people by. So let's go back to basics at the start. I said vital. Why so vital?
Well, you're absolutely right. What's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circuit, or AMOC, is a major ocean current that carries warm water north across the Atlantic. You can think of it as a conveyor belt for ocean circulation. In the UK, if you were to take the same latitude, we would be sort of halfway up Canada, but we're much warmer. This is the reason. And crucially, this conveyor has two stable states, a strong mode, which we live in now, and a much weaker one that has existed during ice ages. And the concern is that we're pushing it from one state to the other.
And if it does go into the weaker mode, it's not just a question of us being colder. It affects all kinds of things, including, quite crucially, agriculture.
Absolutely. So agriculture in particular could be severely disruptive. The OECD has predicted, because this, of course, doesn't just affect the UK, it's a global impact, that half the land used for wheat and maize around the world could become unsuitable. So the impact of that on humanity overall would be devastating. And one of the things that's come out of this report is not only that the models that were previously used, now that they have combined real world observations, they can see it's the more pessimistic scenarios that are more likely. And if we did trigger it, and as you said, the likelihood is rising, the cooling could happen very quickly.
When you say if we trigger it, what do you mean by that?
Well, so what's happening is that as the Greenland is melting and more fresh water is going to the North Atlantic, it's affecting the salinity, and that's changing the power of this current. So what they found in this report is an estimated slowdown of between 42 and 58% in the coming decades before the end of the century. That level is almost certain to end in collapse, because like so many things in the climate system, you push it far enough and then it gets to a tipping point and then you can't really turn it back on again.
Interesting. So what would we need to do to stop that at this point, to stop that from happening?
Well, look, I mean, there's no guarantees in life, but this is happening because we're pumping greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere and we're warming the climate. And the longer this goes on, the greater the chance of crossing the tipping point. And, you know, the red warning light has been flashing for so long, we've kind of become used to it and it's hard to see it. But, you know, if you'd been smoking for 20 years, you'd been told you had a 50% chance of getting cancer, you'd be pretty wise to give up the cigarettes. Does this guarantee you won't get cancer? There's no guarantees in life. It's kind of the wrong question. We have time to do something that can potentially make a profound difference to us and to all of nature, all humanity, for now and into the future. We should do it while we have the chance.
Mm-hmm. But will world leaders take that moment? Because right now, many of them are distracted, let's say, with other things.
Well, this is such an interesting moment and it's such an interesting test for humanity. There are always millions of things going on. There's always crises. There's always challenges. And the task for world leaders is to lift their sights and say, if this were to happen, if we were to lose half of arable land around the world, all of the issues that we face today would be completely dwarfed by the context we would get into. So that's a leadership moment. It's on them. And if we just expand time forward, go forward a couple of generations and look back to this moment, it's going to be sort of completely unimaginable that we would not have actually taken action. Mm. That's on world leaders, but it's on all of us to demand it as well. That's what will make it happen.
Tom Rivett-Carnac from the Outrage and Optimism podcast. Thank you.
8 minutes to seven is the time. The government's line is that Peter Mandelson's failure to pass the full vetting procedure before he became US ambassador was never communicated to the Prime Minister. That's why they seem to have fired overnight the senior civil servant at the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins. Ollie Robbins left his post, certainly, overnight. Sir Keir, meanwhile, we are told, is furious that he was kept in the dark. Let us talk to Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, who's on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
And what do you make of the firing of Ollie Robbins?
Well, I don't think the Prime Minister can get out of his responsibility by sacking Ollie Robbins. I think the buck has to stop with Mrs. Starmer. I think, frankly, it's inconceivable that on such a sensitive matter, the permanent secretary of the Foreign Office wouldn't have referred to ministers on this. Let's remember that's not in the civil service culture at that high level. He'd only just got into the job. It would have been a high-risk decision to take. And it's also a matter of national security. Essentially, the Foreign Office have found that Peter Mandelson should not be given top secret information. That surely would have been communicated to the Prime Minister.
And to the Foreign Secretary at the time, David Lammy.
Yeah, I think the story that the government, whether it's about the Foreign Secretary or the Prime Minister, the story they're putting out is not credible. But, I mean, let's take a leap of faith, Justin. Let's imagine that they are telling the truth and they really did learn about this only on Tuesday. What does that say about the government and how they're operating? It means people around the Prime Minister were hiding critical information from him, and he took this decision without meeting Mandelson, without knowing about his failed security, but knowing about Mandelson's reputation. I think this shows extraordinarily poor judgment, catastrophically poor judgment. And the actual result is by appointing Peter Mandelson, he endangered national security. We now know, don't we, from the Epstein files, that Mandelson had a record of giving secrets to another country.
Although we don't know, of course, that he's done it in this case at all, or indeed that
By the way, I think there should be inquiry into that, urgent inquiry.
Yeah, but I mean, just to make it plain, Lord Mandelson also denies that he's done anything wrong and has not been found guilty of any offence. But just to move on to what this means for Sir Keir Starmer himself, is it your position that he has misled the Commons? Because he certainly said something in public, didn't he, at a press conference that seemed to suggest that the vetting had been completed and there was no problem in it. And he said, we've got to look again at the vetting process. Do you believe also that he's misled the Commons, which, of course, would be a more serious offence?
Well, I think the evidence suggests that he misled the Commons and misled the public. That's against all the rules. And that's why we've called for him to go. And I think that if he doesn't go, we're going to have to take some action in Parliament.
Does the fact that it might have been inadvertent, this misleading, does that make a difference?
I think in this case, well, first of all, it's hard to believe it was inadvertent and that he didn't know. I think it just stretches credibility, Justin. But even if that is a true story, it shows that there was total negligence and incompetence right at the top of his government. And he didn't take this decision seriously enough. You know, this was a massive decision. It was a political decision. It's clear that the Foreign Office were not in favour of it, and he overruled it. And let's remember, the Prime Minister held the Conservatives to account when he was leader of the opposition, when Boris Johnson was clearly lying over Partygate. And you know, Keir Starmer called for all the accountability and indeed for Boris Johnson to go. He was right on that, and we agree with him. But I'm afraid now he has to take his own medicine. I'm afraid all the evidence suggests he's going to have to go.
Which will lead some to say, hang on a second. Yes, in the parliamentary battles at Westminster, all of this is grist to the mill of the various opposition parties. But actually, there is a really serious international situation. There's no obvious replacement for Keir Starmer. It actually would not do this country any good to lose its prime minister at this juncture.
Well, you're right on one level. It's a hugely serious situation. However, at least the government got it right in over the Iran war and didn't join Donald Trump over his idiotic and damaging war and didn't take the advice of the Conservatives or reform. And we have actually given some praise for that decision because we had argued that we shouldn't back Trump. Trump is totally out of control. But that therefore puts the UK government in a stronger position. And I think on the issue of Mr. Mandelson, Starmer has to be held to account.
Sorry, David. Thank you very much for talking to us.
The most haunted house in England, or a Victorian ghost hunter's elaborate hoax? Witnesses to genuine poltergeist activity, or a 1960s Yorkshire family with an overactive imagination? Join me, Danny Robbins, and my team of paranormal experts as we dig deep into the past, reopening classic cases and searching for the truths they left behind. Secrets still remain. Uncanny cold cases. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather for the day ahead with Sarah Keith Lucas. Morning.
Good morning to you, Anna. Well, we've got a bit of an unsettled day today as a weather front tracks its way from west to east. So many of us are going to see rain at times. It's going to be quite breezy. But then as high pressure builds, the weather's going to improve into the weekend. So today, if you are across South East England, East Anglia and the East Midlands, you're in for a mainly dry day. We've got a little bit of drizzle around first thing and some cloud, but sunshine will develop, the breeze will pick up too, and it'll feel reasonably warm with a southwesterly breeze. Top temperatures 18, possibly 19 Celsius here. For South West England, Wales, the West Midlands and Northern England, most places are starting dry, if somewhat cloudy, but there's already some rain just pushing in from the Irish Sea. So rain for western parts of Wales, for instance, this morning. That area of rain will track eastwards across the region as we head through the latter part of the morning. So yes, some rain on the way, the breeze picking up too, but it will clear through the afternoon to leave sunny spells and highs here around 15 or 16 degrees. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, pretty wet, breezy start to the day. Heaviest of the rain across western parts of Scotland, quite patchy elsewhere. But the rain will track its way eastwards. We'll see sunshine and showers following behind it. So brightening up, I think, as we head into the afternoon. But it will be windy, gusts 40 to 50 miles an hour in the far northwest and highs around 14 or 15 degrees here. Now through tonight, rain will clear away towards the southeast. We've still got some showers through the night across Scotland and Northern Ireland too, but it will be a mild frost-free start to the weekend. And there'll be plenty of dry weather through the weekend, few showers around in the north and the west on Saturday, but more widespread sunshine into Sunday.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 17th of April. The headlines this morning. The civil servant in charge of the Foreign Office has lost his job, with the Prime Minister said to be furious over the department's failure to reveal that Lord Mandelson had failed security vetting before becoming US ambassador. We'll be talking to our political editor Chris Mason. We'll hear as well from Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the Conservatives, in the next hour, and from the government at 8:10. A ceasefire is now in force in Lebanon, which could lead to an end in the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. And President Trump says Iran has agreed to hand over its enriched uranium.
Also coming up in the next hour of the programme, a new film sees Sir David Attenborough follow the descendants of the Rwandan mountain gorilla Pablo, who he first filmed nearly 50 years ago. We'll hear from the film's producer on what's changed over the decades for the gorillas. And the Artemis commander, Reid Wiseman, reflects on the moment that the crew named a newly spotted lunar crater after his late wife, Carol.
For my two daughters to get to see that, no words.
You can hear that whole interview on the way before 8 o'clock this morning. The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, is leaving his job after his department did not inform the Prime Minister that Lord Mandelson had failed security vetting for the post of US ambassador. Downing Street sources say Sir Keir Starmer is furious after only finding out about this on Tuesday. Opposition parties are calling on Sir Keir to resign, saying he misled Parliament when he told the Commons last year that full due process had been followed during Lord Mandelson's appointment. Here's our political correspondent, Damien Grammaticus.
The downfall of Sir Ollie Robbins was swift. It came after Downing Street said that Lord Mandelson had, last year, failed his in-depth security vetting to be ambassador to Washington, but was appointed anyway as Foreign Office officials overrode the checks. In an extraordinary twist, Number 10 said the Prime Minister had not been aware of any of this until this week. Then, late last night, it was announced Sir Ollie, one of the most high-profile civil servants of the last decade, was leaving. It's understood Sir Keir and the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper had lost confidence in him. Opposition parties were swift to say Sir Keir too should go. The Prime Minister is expected to give a statement on the revelations to the House of Commons on Monday. The BBC understands that Lord Mandelson had no knowledge that he had not passed the vetting approval, and the first he heard of it was yesterday.
The Conservatives say that if the Prime Minister didn't know about the failed vetting, it showed incompetence in Downing Street and he should resign. Reform UK and the Greens have also called on Sir Keir to quit. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, told us that Downing Street's version of events stretched credulity.
Even if that is a true story, it shows that there was total negligence and incompetence right at the top of his government. I think the evidence suggests that he misled the Commons and misled the public. That's against all the rules, and that's why we've called for him to go. And I think that if he doesn't go, we're going to have to take some action in Parliament.
With his assessment of how damaging this episode is for the Prime Minister, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
The Prime Minister's decision to send Lord Mandelson to Washington is like a horror film stuck on repeat for Sir Keir Starmer. The whole saga has now cost another person at the centre of government their job, and there are some, both on the opposition benches and within the Labour Party, who think it might yet cost the Prime Minister his. This whole thing was already a grimace-through-his-fingers affair for Sir Keir, without an unlikely twist like this, dredging it back into the limelight yet again and prompting sharp questions as to whether he was insufficiently curious about the vetting process. And all this before the next deluge of documents about Lord Mandelson's appointment that Parliament has demanded and we were already anticipating. The Prime Minister is, I'm told, absolutely furious. Labour MPs are none too pleased either that this mess is making headlines again.
A 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon that Hezbollah has indicated it will abide by has come into effect. The truce was brokered by the United States after 6 weeks of fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed group. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Beshega sent this report from Beirut.
At the stroke of midnight, gunfire and fireworks in Beirut celebrated the start of the ceasefire. In the city of Sidon to the south, smiling crowds gathered as people tried to return home. And in the dark, work had already begun to repair the bridges that had been destroyed by Israel in the war. In the first hours of the truce, the Lebanese army said Israel had committed some violations, including the shelling of villages. Hezbollah has indicated it will abide by the ceasefire. The Lebanese are desperate for some respite. But Hezbollah is keeping its weapons, invading Israeli troops remain inside Lebanese territory, and Israel may even continue to attack Lebanon. This may be a pause, but not the end.
President Trump says Iran has agreed to hand over its enriched uranium, one of the key sticking points in negotiations to bring the war to an end. Fresh talks, he said, could resume as early as this weekend, with both sides very close to making a deal. Our chief international correspondent Lise Doucette is in Tehran. She's reporting from there on the condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, a restriction that applies to all international media organisations operating in the country.
Iran's foreign ministry issued a statement welcoming the 10-day ceasefire in Lebanon, saying it had always insisted the agreement included the region. The temporary truce, now in force here for more than a week, is still holding. And diplomacy intensifies to try to reach a wider deal between Tehran and Washington. But there's been no official reaction to President Trump's remarks that Iran has agreed to stop its nuclear enrichment and hand over what he called its nuclear dust, a reference to more than 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. But sources cast doubt on the president's optimistic claim. There are reports the gap could be closing between the US's reported demand for a 20-year moratorium on enrichment and Iran's first 5-year offer. These are highly technical and deeply sensitive issues. Negotiators who were involved in previous nuclear talks emphasize they take time and tough compromises to resolve. But Mr. Trump is already speaking about ending a half century of enmity with the Islamic Republic within days.
France and the UK are to share a meeting in Paris aimed at establishing a multinational force to ensure safe passage for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. 30 leaders are expected to take part in the discussions, either in person or by video link. The US, Iran and Israel won't be involved. Officials have said any operation would start once the war had ended. A powerful new AI model called Mythos has been causing concern among finance ministers and bankers gathered at the International Monetary Fund in the United States. There are fears that it could undermine the security of bank accounts. More from our economics editor Faisal Islam, who's in Washington, where the IMF is meeting.
One major concern looms over the meetings here, almost as much as the Gulf blockade. A powerful new AI system, not yet released to the public, has already exposed multiple potential security vulnerabilities in some critical financial systems. Mythos has been developed by Anthropic, the company best known for the Claude model. Governments and banks are being offered access to Mythos in advance to help protect their own systems. Canada's finance minister, Philippe-François Champagne, told the BBC it has been discussed at the G7 meeting.
C.S. Venkatakrishnan is the chief executive of Barclays.
We have to understand it better, and we have to understand the vulnerabilities that are being exposed and fix them quickly. But this is what the new world is going to be.
The Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey also told the BBC the model had to be taken very seriously because of the risk of cyber criminals exploiting it. The US Treasury confirmed it had raised the issue with its banks to ready their systems before any public release of Mythos by Anthropic.
The billionaire co-founder of Netflix, Reed Hastings, is leaving the company after almost 30 years. He was chief executive for most of that time, overseeing its transformation from sending customers DVDs in the post to a global streaming platform. Netflix says Mr. Hastings will step down as chairman in June and plans to focus on philanthropy and other pursuits.
Thank you, Chris. It's 7:09 now. What did the Prime Minister know and when about the fact that Peter Mandelson failed his vetting to become Britain's ambassador to the US, but took up the job anyway? So Keir Starmer's knowledge of the process was first called into question, you remember, when this story broke months ago. But this is a new layer of detail. The top civil servant in the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, is now leaving his job because of it. But it again raises pointed issues. If the Prime Minister wasn't told, why not? Where was his curiosity about the background checks on a man who'd already left government in disgrace during his career? And should a decision so significant have been made without the full informed knowledge of the man who leads the country? Chris Mason, our political editor, is with us. Chris, good morning.
Morning.
We've already heard from Sir Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, and we will hear the same from Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative leader, at 7:50. They think this message from Downing Street that the Prime Minister did not know that that vetting was failed, they think that that doesn't stack up. It can't be true.
Yeah, in essence, that is their position. I think we'll hear from the Conservatives and others today. Hang on, how come it's with the Prime Minister, it's always someone else's fault? Meanwhile, you have folk in Whitehall, in the depths of government, astonished by this turn of events. Yesterday, we had the incredible spectacle, really, of this sort of flotilla of folk saying or making it be known, you know, I had no idea, Gov, or worse to that effect, not least the Prime Minister, Lord Mandelson himself, David Lammy, who was then the Foreign Secretary, Morgan McSweeney, the former Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister. What I'm told happened is that the Prime Minister had found out late on Tuesday night as part of this government process of churning through documents ahead of Parliament's demand to publish them, connected to Lord Mandelson's appointment. That's to comply with this so-called humble address, that all this stuff should see the light of day. Last night, there was a phone conversation between the Prime Minister and Sir Ollie Robbins, this veteran senior figure in Whitehall, who formerly was the Brexit negotiator. He is now out on his ear, and we'll hear from the Prime Minister on Monday, who will come to Parliament and say a load of stuff that he will say he didn't know at the time when he didn't say it in Parliament before.
Yes. And so to go back to the opposition position, Chris, you've got, on the one hand, as we said, they say this can't possibly have been the case. He must have known. But then their counter-argument, and the thing that really boxes Sir Keir Starmer into a corner, doesn't it, is they say, well, look, if you didn't know, why didn't you ask? Did you not want to know the result of that process? Are you incompetent?
Yeah, that charge of insufficient curiosity from a man that opposition leaders point out is scrupulous around process is a stinging one. It is less stinging, we should say, than a situation where we were talking this morning and Downing Street were unable to say on the record that the Prime Minister didn't know until Tuesday night. And absolutely key to this is page 7 of the Ministerial Code, chapter 1, paragraph 1.6c, in case you wondered, which you probably didn't. But anyway, it says, it is of paramount importance that ministers give accurate and truthful information to Parliament, correcting any error at the earliest opportunity. That rather explains why the Prime Minister will be in the Commons on Monday. At the next sentence, ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament will be expected to offer their resignation to the Prime Minister. Knowingly is absolutely key there, and the Prime Minister's defence will be, I didn't know. But as you say, the obvious question will be, why?
Just the very quickest of thoughts, Chris. If the Prime Minister knew on Tuesday, would Wednesday not have been the first possible opportunity?
Well, I asked that very question of them. They say that they spent the time between Tuesday night and last night, basically getting their ducks in a row, trying to find out who within the system knew and when, I guess to ensure, they say, that what they said last night was absolutely watertight. But yeah, others will ask that question too, given that's what it says in the code.
Yeah, so still up for debate. Thank you, Chris. As always, Chris Mason, our political editor. Lord Beamish also joins us, chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, that cross-party group of MPs and peers who are reviewing documents relating to Peter Mandelson's appointment. Lord Beamish, good morning.
Good morning.
You're here to talk about the process side of things. Would you have expected the Prime Minister to have been told this detail about Lord Mandelson's vetting being failed?
Well, the humble address is very clear. It sets out that documents relating to his appointment need to be provided to Parliament. We're just dealing with the ones relating to those that are sensitive for covering national security and international relations. The first I knew about these latest documents was, like everyone did yesterday, we will expect to get those documents, including the vetting documentation and any other emails or documentation from the Foreign Office, and look at them and then decide what can be put in the public domain. And our maxim has been throughout all this process is that we try and put as much as possible in the public domain.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's worth considering as well that the things that you are going through now, the documents that you are looking at, there are people out there who know exactly what happened in this situation because they were in the room when those decisions were made. And it might be easier for them to perhaps contact the committee and tell you rather than giving you the job of sifting through all of the bits of paper trying to work out what went on.
No, well, that's not our role. Our role has been given to us by Parliament, which is to look through these documents. It is not our job to decide which documents we get. That's the government's.
No, I think, apologies, Lord Beamish. So the point that I was making is you're spending a lot of time trying to piece together events which people lived through and they know what happened and they could perhaps tell you and save you that job.
Well, no, but that's not what Parliament's told us to asked us to do. And we are, you know, working. And I also want to stress the volume of the information which we're dealing with. I mean, you know, there's huge amounts of documentation. The material we're dealing with, we have to read as individual committee members. We have to also then meet as a committee, decide what we think needs redacting, what can be put in the public domain. And remember, that all has all got to be done in a secure environment, which are our secure offices. So we can't take it away and read it, for example. So that's why the process possibly is taking longer than some people expect. But it is, and I can assure Parliament and the public that the committee is taking this very seriously. And our aim is to try and put as much as possible in the public domain. And then it's for people to answer why they took certain actions which they took. And we've been very clear that embarrassment, either politically or personally, is not a ground for redaction.
Are you concerned about The Guardian reporting that there was debate in the Cabinet Office about whether or not to share certain documents with your committee?
Well, that's not, you know, that's not our experience so far. We've been getting documents, we're dealing with them. If they'd done that, I think it would have been very silly on them because I think they would have been found out. But what we're doing, and we look forward to getting these latest documents to see what is actually in them. But it does raise a wider point, which I think will be an issue which we may well want to reflect on at the end and report to Parliament on. And that's the way intelligence is handled within government. This was not only pertinent to this government, but it was one concern that we had with previous government as well, and how that intelligence being used. The other point is, which I think is a broader point, is the way in which different communications systems are being used to conduct what in some cases is very sensitive and highly classified information.
Lord Beamish, Chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, thank you for joining us. We'll hear from the Conservatives at 10 to 8 and from the government at 10 past 8.
Time now, 17 minutes past 7. The 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon is hugely important, of course, for the civilians in southern Lebanon caught up in the fighting, but also for the wider prospects for the US-Iran ceasefire to be continued and even potentially to end in some sort of agreement. Let us talk to Lina Khatib, who's Associate Fellow focused on the Middle East at the Think House Chatham House in London. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make of the prospects for this ceasefire holding? Because there have been accusations that it hasn't been, but still some confidence, I think, on both sides that it might in the longer term. How likely do you think it is that this will be a real ceasefire that leads to something?
There is a high likelihood this time, and that's because it is in the interest of all stakeholders to show success. Of course, for the US, President Trump has already given himself credit for the ceasefire. He wants to show that he is ending wars. For Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu has said that the ceasefire does not mean that Israel will withdraw from Lebanon, but he also needs to show results. The same applies to Iran, actually, and Hezbollah. Iran has already given itself credit for the ceasefire by claiming that it is the result of its negotiations with the US and Pakistan. So because everyone wants to show success, there is a greater opportunity for the ceasefire to hold.
And for it to lead to what?
Well, eventually, according to the terms of the ceasefire, this is meant to lead to long-term peace between Lebanon and Israel, but that's not something that's going to be achieved in a matter of weeks. The issue is very complicated. It has to do with border demarcation, the disarmament of Hezbollah, and withdrawal of Israel from Lebanese territory. And these are three very complicated issues. But we have to start somewhere, and this is a historic move, actually, because it paves the way for Lebanon and Israel to continue direct negotiations.
I suppose the hope among some was that with Iran weakened and potentially its lifeline, as it were, to Hezbollah, if not cut off, then reduced, that gives the Lebanese authorities a greater power over Hezbollah, and they might be able to say, look, enough of this, we are going to do a deal with Israel.
I mean, absolutely. Already the direct meeting that happened between the Lebanese ambassador and the Israeli ambassador last Tuesday has started the process of removing the Lebanon card from Iran's hands. So this is not just in Lebanon's favor, allowing Lebanon to finally become sovereign and not under Iranian oversight. But this is also important for weakening Iran's own position in its negotiations with the US, because Iran is losing its cards militarily. It's not been successful. Now it's no longer going to be able to use Lebanon as a bargaining chip. Even its blockade on the Strait of Hormuz has been met with a US blockade. So eventually the regional balance of power is shifting away from Iran.
Lina Khatib, Associate Fellow at Chatham House. Thank you very much.
20 past seven, one of the co-founders of the streaming giant Netflix is to step down from its board as the company continues to grow. Fliss is back with more on that.
Yes, so the chairman, Reed Hastings, was there at the very start of the business 29 years ago. He says he wants to focus now on philanthropy and other interests. This comes as Netflix publishes its first results since it lost the £53 billion deal for Warner Brothers Discovery to Paramount. Let's get into all of that with Brian Weiser, CEO at the advertising and media consultancy Madison and Wall. Brian, good morning. How key has Mr. Hastings been to the business since it started?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Clearly, Hastings has been critical to everything we know and think about what Netflix is today. I mean, turning it from a barely startup into an industry behemoth. There's no question the current shape is exclusively because of Reed Hastings.
Yes, I suppose streaming didn't exist in the way that we think of it now back then. But what about that deal I mentioned, the failed deal to try and secure Warner Brothers Discovery? Has that slowed down Netflix's growth?
Evidently, no. I mean, I think that they were able to pursue that without being meaningfully distracted, and they're going to wind up with a lot of extra cash for the efforts. So it's not bad overall. I think it's safe to say that the focus that they've had on doing what they do organically, for the most part, has helped them. It means they haven't had distractions of integration. And so they get to keep doing what they've been doing without those distractions.
One of the big changes, of course, the Reed Hastings oversaw was Netflix adding advertising to its model. How's that playing out? Because there was some skepticism.
Well, let's be clear. I think Hastings was the one who kind of put his foot down and said, yep, we're going to do it. But I think the current team can take credit for actually implementing on the advertising matter, which is something that I think was a matter of debate for quite some time. So executing it and doing it in a way that didn't cause a decline or didn't cause a meaningful dissatisfaction or slow down the growth of subscribers or revenue growth was, you know, really uncertain. But I think it's safe to say that it's been helpful on the margins. I think when paired with the password sharing crackdown, making it available to more subscribers or more potential households at different price points, it's been helpful.
And yet, investors, we saw Netflix shares slide after their latest announcement, even though its first quarter revenues were up 16%. What's going on?
Well, I think there's always going to be mismatches between expectations of investors and the company's own expectations. The company does what the company does. They do the best they can. It's done pretty well. And they focus on what they are doing and running a business. And they're very unlike most companies on that are publicly traded. They basically say, this is how we're running the business. Investors, you're welcome to join us while we do it.
Brian Weiser, CEO at Madison & Wall. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Fliss. 23 minutes past seven is the time. The new film, A Gorilla Story, begins with Sir David Attenborough reading from his diary in 1978, recounting his first meeting with the Rwandan mountain gorilla Pablo. The encounter captured in his series Life on Earth created what Attenborough himself considers the most famous sequence in any documentary that he filmed. Pablo ended up becoming the most successful gorilla on record, producing a 60-strong group spanning generations. The documentary, which is out today, follows the unique story of these great apes and the survival of their dynasty.
There are many different personalities within the Pablo group today. And there is one who reminds me of Pablo himself. Not only does he look very similar, he seems to have the same boldness and curiosity.
Let's talk to Alistair Fothergill, the Emmy-winning producer of several Attenborough documentaries, it is fair to say, producer of A Gorilla Story as well. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And what a story it is.
It is an amazing story, actually, and it inspired us. I mean, that sequence, as you said, is probably the most famous sequence in wildlife filmmaking. The little tiny three-year-old Pablo that grew up so successfully over 30 years to be the most successful silverback ever. In that same period, there was a wonderful conservation story, because when Diane Fossey was there with David in 1978, there were only around 250 gorillas left. And through very careful conservation, there are now over 600 in Rwanda. And we were lucky to go back and spend a record 250 days with two cameramen filming the Pablo group today. And I have to say, gorillas are famous for not doing very much usually, but we were unbelievably lucky. And over that 2 years of filming, an extraordinary soap opera played out in the modern day Pablo family.
Yeah, which, I mean, I called him in the beginning the most successful gorilla ever. What does that mean?
Well, to be a successful silverback gorilla is to have as many females in your group as possible. And typically, that could be around 25 or 30 gorillas in the total group. Pablo did a deal with another silverback called Cantersby, quite a rare deal, really, where he basically said, let's cooperate. Silverback gorillas rarely cooperate, but Pablo said, let's cooperate, and we'll build a big group and we'll share the girls. And it worked out very, very well indeed.
Do you, what have we learned? You say it's a great story, and it's a wonderful conservation story as well. It's a real success story, and we don't have an awful lot of those at the moment. Has it also changed our sort of view of gorillas? Not just that we've learned more, but that we view them differently.
I mean, when the sequence in Life on Earth came out in 1978, I mean, it was watched, I think, by over 500 million people around the world. And it totally changed people's understanding of gorillas. Before then, I think they'd been associated with the sort of King Kong rumour. They were seen as aggressive, you know, powerful, dangerous animals. And actually, when people saw David lying among these gorillas, they realized that what they are, they're unbelievably peaceful. I mean, they're very powerful. The silverbacks are, you know, four times the size of, you know, an adult human male, and they're very capable of, you know, basically knocking your head off with a swing of their arm. But that's not what they are. They're very, very peaceful, beautiful, majestic animals. And it was an extraordinary privilege for us and the cameramen to work among these animals for such a long period.
Alistair Fothergill, producer of several documentaries, but as I say, mainly producer of A Gorilla Story, and A Gorilla Story is out today.
It's 27 minutes past seven. It's time for the sport. Mike is back. Hello.
Hello, Anna. Good morning. For the first time since 1984, Nottingham Forest are into a European semi-final. They beat Porto 1-0 last night to win their Europa League quarter-final 2-1 on aggregate. It set up an all-English tie in the last four with Aston Villa, who thrashed Bologna in their quarter-final second leg last night. Meanwhile, Crystal Palace are now favourites to win the Europa Conference League. They'll face Shakhtar Donetsk in the semi-finals, despite defeat to Fiorentina last night in their quarter-final. We now, though, are going to talk about LIV Golf, because for 4 years now, they have positioned themselves as the sport's noisy disruptor.
A new LIV Golf season is here.
Send it.
Let's go, Bryson.
Teaming up golf's most sensational players. Season starts now. LIV Golf, get into a new dimension.
Well, that is one of the slick social media adverts for LIV Golf, but does the sport's controversial breakaway league now face an uncertain future? Their chief executive, Scott O'Neill, has told players that the 2026 season will continue as planned and uninterrupted amid rumours that the tour is on the verge of collapse after Saudi Arabia's public investment fund were reportedly set to end their support for the tour. But speaking overnight in Mexico ahead of the next LIV event, O'Neill insists it's business as usual.
We're really excited about where we are and the position where we are. If we keep the trajectory going the way we are and the revenue growth going, this is going to be a really good business for a really long time. We did almost $500 million in sponsorship last year. So I'm like thinking we're in a wonderful position.
Well, let's have a brief chat, shall we, with the BBC's golf correspondent, Ian Carter, who joins us. So, Ian, nothing to see here, says Scott O'Neill, but a lot of people will say no smoke without fire. What's the latest as you understand it?
Yes, hello, Mike. Well, it was an enthusiastic response to this week's stories, very upbeat about LIV's prospects and critical of the reporting, which O'Neill said relied exclusively on unnamed sources. However, if you drill down into what he said, and he was saying it on LIV's own TV coverage, there was no direct rebuttal, no denial that Saudi Arabia could be about to pull the plug on their funding of LIV Golf, and he did accept that the project is challenging. I think what was interesting in what he had to say was that his business model is looking to target national opens around the world. Now, these are events that are currently mainly being held on the European-based DP World Tour, so we might be seeing a strategic shift there.
And do we take this decision by the Public Investment Fund, if it does indeed to turn out to be true, to be partly or wholly as a consequence of events in the Middle East at the moment?
Well, I think that is a contributory factor. We've also seen published the objectives for Saudi Arabia going forward for the next 4 years, and sport was conspicuous by its absence. Now, we know that the 2034 Men's Football World Cup is going to be staged in Saudi Arabia. That is going to be an exceptionally expensive project. Obviously, the war is occurring as well. So there are pressures there that could give cause to the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund to withdraw their funding for projects like LIV Golf, which have burnt up, we're told, up to $5 billion so far.
And just briefly, Ian, what do you think the PGA and DPA World Tours are thinking about all this? Because relations had thawed between them and LIV Golf in recent years. They had got into a bit of a relationship together, hadn't they?
A little bit, but what I think we have seen is the PGA Tour turning round and offering a pathway back to the biggest stars. We saw that with Brooks Koepka, who is now playing on the PGA Tour after turning his back on LIV. Patrick Reed is able to play on the DP World Tour and win back his rights to play on the PGA Tour. I suspect that those established tours are going to be watching and waiting and looking to see if they can capitalize if that funding ceases from Saudi Arabia.
Intriguing and uncertain times in the world of golf. Ian Carter, correspondent, many thanks for your time this morning.
My thank you. Tonight on Radio 4.
The new series of the News Quiz returns with your host, Andy Zaltzman.
You can just make up your own jokes there.
And a panel of comedians trying to find the funny in the news.
What am I talking about?
Apparently we no longer produce children.
Don't make them here anymore. Too much red tape.
It's a niche fetish, but whatever works. The UK is getting sunnier.
It was researchers in Spain that have said this. They're just saying that because they don't want us there.
I do not fly tip, unless the fly has given me especially good service.
The new series of the News Quiz starts tonight at 6:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Take a look at the weather. Only the southeast of England, really, will be dry today. Rain spreading eastwards across much of the UK. Later, it should turn sunnier, but cloud and showers will remain in the north.
We will continue to bring you reaction analysis as well of the news that Lord Mandelson failed security vetting, or seems to have failed security vetting, for his role as US ambassador, something the Prime Minister is saying this morning that he wasn't told about. We'll hear from the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, later in this half hour, and from the government at 8:10.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster, and Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
The Foreign Office's top civil servant is leaving his post after his department did not inform the Prime Minister that Lord Mandelson had failed security vetting for the role of US ambassador. Sir Keir Starmer is understood to have lost confidence in Sir Ollie Robbins. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, told this programme the whole affair showed the government's catastrophic poor judgment in appointing Peter Mandelson and Sir Keir should resign. Likewise, the Conservatives say that if the Prime Minister didn't know about the failed vetting, it showed incompetence in Downing Street and he should go. Reform UK and the Greens have also called on Sir Keir to quit. A 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon has come into effect. Lebanon's army has reported Israeli violations, including intermittent shelling of several villages in the south. Israel said its troops would remain in areas they've occupied. President Trump says the war with Iran should be ending soon after the country agreed to hand over its enriched uranium, one of the key sticking points in negotiations. Fresh talks, he said, could resume as early as this weekend, with Washington and Tehran very close to making a deal. The four Artemis II astronauts have said their mission gave the world a sense of hope and unity at a time when both feel in short supply. The crew spent 10 days in space, the first time humans have ventured near the moon in more than half a century. The billionaire co-founder and chairman of Netflix is leaving the company after almost three decades. Reed Hastings said he wanted to focus on philanthropy and other pursuits.
Thank you for that. 8:25 is the time.
I will say the war in Iran is going along swimmingly. We can do whatever we want. And it should be ending pretty soon. It was perfect. I mean, it's perfect.
Well, that was President Trump speaking overnight at an event in Las Vegas. It is true that he seems to have brokered a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. If that holds, it would pave the way then for Iran potentially to agree to a longer-lasting ceasefire with the US, perhaps even a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. But at the moment, this morning, that strait still seems to be closed. The American strategy is that the economic pain caused by its blockade of Iran, with no oil tankers allowed to pass, including to nations Iran wants to do business with, will persuade Iran to give ground diplomatically and allow a settlement of the war. Robert Wilkie was Veterans Secretary in the first Trump administration. He was a member of the Pentagon transition team this time around. I asked him if he shared the White House's optimism.
No, I don't. I'm not as optimistic as they sound. But then again, with President Trump's way of doing things, you never know what's serious and what's a fog. You know, I actually have more faith in Lebanon straightening itself out, particularly as the financial pipeline to Hezbollah and the weapons pipeline to Hezbollah from Iran is just dried up for as far as we can see into the future. So I think that that's one that might fix itself on its own. But I have absolutely no confidence that the mullahs will negotiate in good faith. I don't know that any deal that they've made that they've kept.
Do you think President Trump could now decide to reopen the war, or has he in his mind decided that it is ended to an extent now that makes the regime in Iran actually relatively safe?
First of all, I think if we leave the regime as it is after all of this, then I think that will be a strategic defeat for the United States, the likes of which we haven't seen in decades, because the reverberations will hit through China, Taiwan. Putin will be emboldened, and the Chinese will have that foothold in the Middle East that they have used, one, to foment trouble for us, and two, to use as a conduit for weapons flowing from the Iranians into Putin's Russia. I mean, the last major attack on Kiev, our own intelligence people said that 3/4 of the drones used by the Russians were made in Iran. And before the attacks began in Iran, we saw pictures of Chinese ships offloading ballistic missile parts at a cosmic rate. And so that's something that is always hanging out there.
What do you think, in that case, his options are?
I think the options are very much British options, if you look at the history of particularly the Royal Navy. This blockade that is in place, and by the way, we have introduced more of the 82nd Airborne Division into the theater. So there are 15,000 troops that are capable, in addition to the 3,000 Marines, of taking Karg Island, of taking islands in the Gulf around the Straits. But I think the use of that blockade, Iran, according to your own Foreign Office, has enough cash reserves for about 6 weeks. Over 60% of the food they get comes through those straits. Remember, there were riots in Iran. The people came out when the rial hit 1.2 million to the dollar. And if this continues, if the blockade continues, I think you will see the beginnings of the crumbling of the regime, in the sense that you will divide the true believers from the fellow travelers, because the regime will not be able to pay the army. It will not be able to pay its militia. And that's sort of the thing we saw on another level with the Shah. And then the question will be, when the people come out in the streets again, do the security forces fire on them? Because if they don't fire on them, then the regime will be, I think, on its last legs.
To which many people who have watched the last few weeks, and indeed some who wished this action well, will say all of this is delusional, because that never happens. And actually what will happen is that the regime will be protected, will outlast President Trump, and the entire action, even if the blockade remains in place, will be a failure.
Well, they said the same thing about Reza Pahlavi. He could not fall.
This is the Shah who fell in 1979.
Right. They had enormous military resources until the thing began to crumble, in the same way that we saw the protests earlier. Last year, when the students came out of the universities and the schools. So, yes, I think that is the one major play that we have left. And that is to try to force this regime to crumble. And that's not something that the president has articulated. It's certainly something Netanyahu articulates. But I agree with the premise of your question. If that does not happen, I think the reverberations will redound, not to the benefit of the United States or the West.
Robert Wilkie, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
It's 19 minutes to 8 now. The Artemis astronauts are back on Earth, and they've been reflecting on their 10-day trip to the moon, holding interviews, giving a bit more of an insight into what that history-making journey was like from the inside. And Reid Wiseman, the mission commander, has been speaking to our science editor, Rebecca Morrell. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning.
So many questions to ask. Probably quite a limited amount of time to ask them as well, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's right. You know, they had a very tightly controlled controlled slots. But yeah, it was fascinating talking to him. And I think one of the things that really surprised me was that the crew had kind of no idea how much the world had been captivated by this mission. So, you know, we knew everything about them, what was going up there in space. And I kind of thought, well, they might have a bit of an inkling about what's going on back down here on Earth, but they really were cut off. And he said it was only when he spoke to his daughters on a call home during the flight, and they said to him, "Dad, this thing has gone crazy down here. You know, you might not want to come back." And he did sound genuinely surprised, having come home to see how big the story was. And I was quite surprised about that. But, you know, he spoke about how he was immensely proud of the crew and of what they'd achieved too. I mean, you got the sense with all of the astronauts, actually, that the experience was really just starting to sink in. It was almost like they couldn't have really grasped what it was like. But one of the things I was very curious about finding out, so when we were at Mission Control in Houston, just before the landing, we spoke to one of the spacecrafts, well, the spacecraft's manager, Howard Hugh, and we said to him, "Howard, what's it going to be like for the astronauts on this sort of ride home? Because they're travelling back at 24,000 miles an hour. The spacecraft is exposed to these absolutely kind of extreme temperatures where it's half as hot as the surface of the sun." And he said, "Do you know what? I don't know, because no humans have ever flown in this spacecraft before." But, you know, Reid Wiseman said he described this experience of going through the Earth's atmosphere, where you have a plasma starting to build up, and a plasma are these sort of superheated charged particles. And he described, as they started to go through the atmosphere, you kind of got this faint pink glow around the spacecraft, which you could see a little bit in the images, but then the signal cut off for 6 minutes because the plasma grew so much. And he described it as sort of growing to this burning white light that was sort of too hard to actually look at, kind of from the spacecraft's window, and then, you know, bits of the separation bolts started to burn as they came through the atmosphere. They were molten red. You know, their awareness was super heightened as this was happening, and then they kind of came through, and suddenly they're plummeting. Kind of, they're back through the atmosphere, but they're still going really fast. And he said that was sort of very disconcerting, just to be free falling. And then the parachutes start to come out. They have a couple of small chutes first and then some big chutes afterwards. So he said it was like an amusement park ride, but the splashdown was actually kind of a soft landing at the end. But I did talk to him about his daughters as well. I mean, he said that the mission had been hard for them because it's come with a lot of risks. And he is a single dad. His wife died sadly 6 years ago from cancer. And he did say his daughters were there in Mission Control when the crew announced that they were naming a crater after his late wife, Carol.
The crew had approached me, Jeremy in particular, had approached me at the Kennedy Space Center and said, "Hey, we've talked. It was Christina's idea, but we think it would be really great to honor Carol." And nobody knows her. Her kids know her. Her family knows her. And I know her. She was just a wonderful, very calm, very competent person. And she loved her two kids. And that morning, I did not know my kids were going into Mission Control. I got an email from one of the flight directors that they were going to head in. And I asked the flight director, it's actually a pretty funny question. I asked the flight director if my kids were there. And I said, "If they don't come in, just lie to me and tell me they're there anyway." And the flight director said, "Oh, actually, they just walked in." That was right when we were about to break the distance record. And then they were there. And we were looking at the moon out the window. And Jeremy goes, "Man, Reid, I think we see Grimaldi, we see Glushko, we see Carol Crater right there." I was like, "Jeremy, it's just for sure, 100%. I mean, just right in front of us." And I turned to Jeremy and I said, I think now's the right time to do this. And he did it. And it was unbelievably powerful. Like, there's no, I cannot describe that. For my two daughters to get to see that, no words.
That was a really special moment, wasn't it? That's Reid Wiseman, the Artemis mission commander, speaking to our science editor, Rebecca Morell.
Just to say, the Prime Minister's decision to send Lord Mandelson to Washington as ambassador coming under intense scrutiny, of course, again this morning after it was revealed, or at least the government is saying that now that he failed the security vetting. In a few minutes, we will talk to the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, and then at 8:10, we'll hear from the government. First, though, thought for the day, the speaker this morning, the Reverend Lucy Winkett, the rector of St James's Piccadilly.
Good morning. I found myself not long ago in a courtroom as a witness for a person claiming asylum in the UK on the grounds that they'd converted to Christianity and would be persecuted in the country they'd been born in if they returned. I'd got to know him well, prepared him to be baptised, and he was a regular member of our congregation. We'd even eaten mustard seeds together as we discussed the meaning of Jesus' teaching in the Gospels about the kingdom of God. In court, he was asked to name the 12 apostles. He got to 5 before mistakenly mentioning Isaiah. The following Sunday, I asked our own congregation, some of whom had been going to church for 50 years, to name the 12 apostles. No one could, and it was gently pointed out that the Gospels themselves don't quite agree on the precise 12, with a question over Thaddeus. Back in the courtroom, I was also asked whether I thought it was possible to be Christian without being able to read. Our congregation member was not literate. I refrain from commenting that for hundreds of years nothing in Christian doctrine was written down until the formation of the creeds in the 4th century, and simply answered, yes, in my opinion, I thought it was possible to be Christian without being able to read. The system was working as it should. The lawyers were doing what the state required them to do. The court had to determine whether this conversion to Christianity was legitimate or not. But learning the apostles' names, or being able to read, was not and could never be the place where true and deep lived faith would breathe and flourish. The discovery that there is, in the words of the BBC reporters, a sham industry providing assistance to people to enter the UK illegally on the grounds of sexuality or belief is not very surprising. Enormous efforts are made by people trying to get round the housing or benefit system, for example, and huge sums are spent employing accountants to minimise the amount, legally or illegally, an individual has to pay in tax. For every bureaucratic system put in place to try to organise society for the good of the whole, there will be a shadow system dedicated to get around it for personal gain. In such shadow systems, the state's attempt at fairness, however imperfectly or carelessly expressed sometimes, is replaced with active cruelty towards the most vulnerable in our society, by traffickers or any who exploit the desperation of those whose life circumstances have placed them at the mercy of the system. State instruments will always be blunt, and political fashions come and go as to which issues attract the most attention. But the collective commitment to compassion, fair judgment, mercy and care towards those who are most in need of help will never, can never, go out of fashion.
That was all for the day. The speaker this morning was the Reverend Lucy Winkett. It brings us to 11 minutes to 8.
The Prime Minister insists he only found out on Tuesday that Peter Mandelson failed security vetting before taking up his job as the UK's ambassador to the United States. That information has emerged seemingly as part of the process by which Parliament is now compelled to publicly release documents pertaining to that appointment. Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the Conservative Party, began that by tabling a humble address back in February. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Reform UK and the Greens have called on the Prime Minister to quit, as have you. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, told us that he thought Downing Street's version of events stretched credulity. I wonder, do you genuinely believe, because politics is all about the cut and thrust, but do you genuinely believe that the Prime Minister lied about this?
Yes, I do. I'm afraid I do. It is completely preposterous for us to believe that when the Prime Minister said on the floor of the House, when I asked him, the full due process was followed, that officials who knew that was not the case would not have told him. He knew. It is preposterous for us to believe that on the 5th of February, him giving a press conference saying that Mandelson was cleared by the security services, nobody told him that actually this was not the case. It is completely preposterous that the Prime Minister, the former chief prosecutor of this country, did not ask basic questions, did not ask to look at the security vetting himself. He must have done. It is also completely preposterous that for us to believe that civil servants would have cleared a political appointee who had failed security vetting. Mandelson was not a Mandarin. He was a Labour Party grandee appointed to be our most senior diplomatic ambassador. It is also unbelievable, I'm afraid, for us to believe that these documents did not go to Parliament by accident. We had requested all of the documents relating to the appointment and this was not there. Mm. We would not have found out for this if not for The Guardian. So I'm afraid the story does not stack up. The Prime Minister is taking us for fools.
On the flip side of that argument, it just seems such a stretch that you would think, as the Prime Minister, that you could get away with something like that. There would be so many people involved. And also that counter-argument, I didn't know. You know, that's surely not something that you would choose to say. As you say, it raises accusations of incompetence. Just when you look at it, it just seems a stretch to say that he lied.
I'm afraid that it is simply not possible for this. It's simply not possible for this to be true. The fact is that the Prime Minister is telling everyone that he was told on Tuesday. The ministerial code states that when a minister discovers something has been the Parliament has been inadvertently misled, they need to correct the record at the first opportunity. The first opportunity was Wednesday morning at Prime Minister's questions. He gave a long sermon about all sorts of things, refused to answer any questions I asked him, and did not tell the House. That in itself is a breach of the ministerial code. But the claiming that the full due process was followed when it wasn't, another breach, misleading Parliament, breaching the ministerial code by telling people that the security services had cleared him. The fact is, all roads lead to a resignation. It doesn't matter what story the Prime Minister is telling. At some point, there is deliberate dishonesty. Whether it's the cover-up story or the original story, one of these is deliberate dishonesty. They can't all be true. That's why I know that he is lying.
Is it the right moment for, and I offer this as a question, not a statement, is this the right moment for the country to lose its Prime Minister? When you consider what is happening in Iran, when you consider the economic crisis, is it the best thing right now for Sir Keir Starmer to resign? The best thing for the country, not for him or for you, but for us, the people?
Well, I think what the country will be asking is, if he is lying about this, what else is he lying about? How do we know that what he's telling us about Iran is true? This man has sacked the cabinet secretary for saying that this Mandelson scandal was his fault. He sacked his chief of staff. He has now sacked the perm sec of the Foreign Office at a time of war.
And that is correct.
My answer is related. I'm directly answering your question, that how can we trust a man who cannot run his own office to run the country? If he is as incompetent as this story is showing, the question we should be asking is this the right person to be in charge with all of the crises that the country is facing? If he is not, we shouldn't just keep him there just because that's what's convenient for the Labour Party.
But the decision that he made about not going to war offensively in Iran and not going with the US and Israel, which is something that you yourself had said that we should do at the time, has been proven over the last few weeks to be the correct decision. So there are moments when he has shown competence in that job.
It is not true that I told him to do that. This is yet another thing that the Prime Minister says that is not true.
So when you said on the 2nd of March, when you posted on X and you said it should not be beyond our government to say they welcome the US and Israel taking action. That was couple of days into the war.
Yes,
what did you mean when you said that?
I asked him to do exactly what the Canadians and the Australians, both run by left-wing prime ministers, had done. Express support, not join in. Verbal support is not the same thing. This is yet another example of Keir Starmer telling people something that is not true. He thinks it is politically convenient for him to misrepresent my position. But let's be honest, this is a man who tells people things that are not true.
You said to GB News on the 6th of March, you said you need to take out the missile launch capability, and that involves offensive military action, not defensive action.
Yes, but I said that after British bases had been attacked. I said if British bases have been attacked, then we need to do everything we can to protect British servicemen and women. That is very different from joining the original strikes. And the Prime Minister actually came over to my position, letting the US use our air bases. But I'm sorry, today is not about my position on the war,
It's questions of competence.
It is questions of competence. The Prime Minister U-turned mind on his position on whether the US should use our bases. I am saying that this man does not either is telling lies or does not know what is going on in his own office. He is not fit. Simply putting his head in the sand is not an expression of competence. Sitting on the fence does not prove any competence.
What we have seen
is that our defence is not in any state to go to war. When the war in Ukraine happened...
there have been many years of a Conservative government, so people would look at that as well. The crumbling of Britain's defence armoury didn't just happen in the last 2 years of a Labour government.
When the war in Ukraine started, we were ready. We had munitions and missiles which we sent in advance.
But we don't have ships.
What we saw under Labour was HMS Dragon stuck in Portsmouth. He paused upgrades. I said this on Wednesday. He paused upgrades to some of our warships because of the Strategic Defence Review and the investment plan that we're still waiting to see.
Anybody you speak to, particularly in the defence echelon, will say that they are decisions that have gone back years under a Labour government and a Conservative
going
government.
Back to 1989.
I wanted to ask you one more thing, Kemi Badenoch.
So going back to 1989, what I'm saying is that
I did want to ask you one last thing, though.
What's happened with
Which we'll run out of time to do. And I do want to ask you. He is not fit.
I do maintain that he is not fit.
So what I wanted to ask you was, Ed Davey was here an hour ago. He said if the Prime Minister does not resign, we need to do something in Parliament. Now, looking back to the humble address, for example, that was something that you did in Parliament. What could you do in Parliament to compel him to resign if that's what you want?
So right now, the people who have the power are Labour MPs. They all need to look at themselves and be honest about the person who is leading the country. With the best will in the world, as the leader of the opposition with 115 MPs, I can call, for all sorts of things, but the fact is it is Labour MPs who need to start making decisions. I do think that this is something that Parliament needs to deal with. There are multiple mechanisms, but the people who have to look hard at themselves right now are the 400 or so Labour MPs who are putting that man in his position.
Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the Conservative Party, thank you for joining. It's a couple of minutes to eight. Plenty to talk about tonight at eight on Any Questions. Let's hear more from Alex Forsyth. Morning, Alex.
Hello, good morning, Anna. Yes, you're not wrong. Tonight we are in Hassocks, a village in Sussex, not far from Brighton. And there is certainly plenty to discuss, whether it is the politics here or developments abroad. On our panel, we have Baroness Angela Smith, a Labour peer and the leader of the House of Lords. Andrew Griffith is the Conservatives' Shadow Secretary of State for Business and Trade. Helen Morgan is the Liberal Democrats' Health and Social Care spokesperson. And Danny Kruger is leading what Reform UK calls its Preparation for Government unit. We will be live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4. I hope you can join us.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Alex. Let's check the weather. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Thank you. We've got three zones of weather to talk you through today. First off, across southeast England, the East Midlands and East Anglia. Here you're going to stay dry for a good part of the day with some sunshine around and it'll feel relatively warm. Temperatures 18 or 19 degrees by the afternoon. For the southwest of England, Wales, through the West Midlands, as well as Northern England and all of Scotland, a cloudy start to the day here, with outbreaks of rain for some, particularly in the west. That rain is going to roll its way towards the east as we head through into the afternoon. It'll be followed, though, by some sunshine. There'll be more showers working in across Scotland, though, heavy and blustery at times, and temperatures generally across this zone about 14 to 16 Celsius. Northern Ireland, lastly, and we're seeing the rain clearing away to the east now, so some sunshine developing here, but there will be further showers as we head into the afternoon, but they will be pretty hit and miss, and top temperatures around about 15 Celsius. Rain should clear away to the southeast overnight, still some showers moving into the northwest, and that sets us up for a mostly dry weekend, but some showers, particularly for Scotland and Northern Ireland, on Saturday.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 17th of April. The headlines this morning, the top civil servant at the Foreign Office has been forced out of his job after it emerged the department overruled security vetting to allow Lord Mandelson to become US ambassador. We'll hear from the government. It is Darren Jones, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, who is speaking this morning. You can hear from him after the bulletin. A ceasefire has come into effect between Israel and Lebanon, while President Trump has said Iran is ready to hand over its enriched uranium. And government ministers and senior bankers have expressed concern that a powerful new AI model could pose a danger to the financial sector. Also coming up in the next hour of the programme, Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent, tells us what she's been seeing inside Iran. And I've been hearing why Donald Trump's feud with the Pope could be a particularly tricky one for him.
you're blessed insofar as you follow what God wants you to do, right? So no one has that divine mandate to do whatever they want.
The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, is leaving his job after Downing Street said his department had not informed the Prime Minister that Lord Mandelson had failed security vetting for the post of US ambassador. Number 10 sources say Sir Keir Starmer is furious after only finding out about this on Tuesday. Opposition parties are calling on Sir Keir to resign, saying he misled Parliament when he told the Commons last year that full due process had been followed during Lord Mandelson's appointment. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
The downfall of Sir Ollie Robbins was swift. It came after Downing Street said that Lord Mandelson had, last year, failed his in-depth security vetting to be ambassador to Washington, but was appointed anyway as Foreign Office officials overrode the checks. In an extraordinary twist, Number 10 said the Prime Minister had not been aware of any of this until this week. Then, late last night, it was announced Sir Ollie, one of the most high-profile civil servants of the last decade, was leaving. It's understood Sir Keir and the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper had lost confidence in him. Opposition parties were swift to say Sir Keir too should go. The Prime Minister is expected to give a statement on the revelations to the House of Commons on Monday. The BBC understands that Lord Mandelson had no knowledge that he had not passed the vetting approval, and the first he heard of it was yesterday.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davies, said Downing Street's version of events stretched credulity, and even if it was true, the Prime Minister should resign for incompetence. Reform UK and the Greens have also called on Sir Keir to quit. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, told us she did not think the Prime Minister was being honest.
It is completely preposterous that the Prime Minister, the former chief prosecutor of this country, did not ask basic questions, did not ask to look at the security vetting himself. He must have done. It is also completely preposterous that for us to believe that civil servants would have cleared a political appointee who had failed security vetting.
With his assessment of how damaging this episode is for the Prime Minister, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
The Prime Minister's decision to send Lord Mandelson to Washington is like a horror film stuck on repeat for Sir Keir Starmer. The whole saga has now cost another person at the centre of government their job, and there are some, both on the opposition benches and within the Labour Party, who think it might yet cost the Prime Minister his. This whole thing was already a grimace-through-his-fingers affair for Sir Keir, without an unlikely twist like this, dredging it back into the limelight yet again and prompting sharp questions as to whether he was insufficiently curious about the vetting process. And all this before the next deluge of documents about Lord Mandelson's appointment that Parliament has demanded and we were already anticipating. The Prime Minister is, I'm told, absolutely furious. Labour MPs are none too pleased either that this mess is making headlines again.
A 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon that Hezbollah has indicated it will abide by has come into effect. The truce was brokered by the United States after 6 weeks of fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed group. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Beshega sent this report from Beirut.
At the stroke of midnight, gunfire and fireworks in Beirut celebrated the start of the ceasefire. In the city of Sidon to the south, smiling crowds gathered as people tried to return home. And in the dark, work had already begun to repair the bridges that had been destroyed by Israel in the war. In the first hours of the truce, the Lebanese army said Israel had committed some violations, including the shelling of villages. Hezbollah has indicated it will abide by the ceasefire. The Lebanese are desperate for some respite. But Hezbollah is keeping its weapons, invading Israeli troops remain inside Lebanese territory, and Israel may even continue to attack Lebanon. This may be a pause, but not the end.
President Trump says Iran has agreed to hand over its enriched uranium, one of the key sticking points in negotiations to bring the war to an end. Fresh talks, he said, could resume as early as this weekend, with both sides very close to making a deal. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Tehran. She's reporting from there on the condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, a restriction that applies to all international media organisations operating in the country.
Iran's foreign ministry issued a statement welcoming the 10-day ceasefire in Lebanon, saying it had always insisted the agreement included the region. The temporary truce, now in force here for more than a week, is still holding, and diplomacy intensifies to try to reach a wider deal between Tehran and Washington. But there's been no official reaction to President Trump's remarks that Iran has agreed to stop its nuclear enrichment and hand over what he called its nuclear dust, a reference to more than 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. But sources cast doubt on the president's optimistic claim. There are reports the gap could be closing between the US's reported demand for a 20-year moratorium on enrichment and Iran's first 5-year offer. These are highly technical and deeply sensitive issues. Negotiators who were involved in previous nuclear talks emphasize they take time and tough compromises to resolve. But Mr. Trump is already speaking about ending a half century of enmity with the Islamic Republic within days.
France and the UK are to chair a meeting in Paris aimed at establishing a multinational force to ensure safe passage for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. The US, Iran and Israel aren't involved in the discussions. Any operation won't happen immediately, as our Paris correspondent James Waterhouse explains.
Today's meeting, which will be mostly virtual, will see around 40 countries, as well as the International Maritime Organization, try to form an initiative, they say, a combined military effort to ensure the Strait of Hormuz is opened immediately after the war ends and stays that way. The plans include the demining of the route, through which a fifth of the world's oil used to flow, intelligence sharing, military escorts, as well as ensuring Iran does not charge vessels for passing through. Organisers here are stressing that this is a defensive measure and not a contribution to a US-Israeli-led war, which most of today's participants see as lacking a legal basis. This seems, for now, to be more of a political proposition to support the fragile ceasefires that are in place across the Middle East and restore confidence to both oil shipping companies and global markets.
Myanmar has reduced the prison sentence of the former leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The 80-year-old was serving 27 years for offences her allies said were politically motivated, ranging from incitement and corruption to election fraud and violating a state secrets law. Her lawyer said the sentence had been cut by one-sixth. A powerful new AI model called Mythos has been causing concern among finance ministers and bankers gathered at the International Monetary Fund in the United States. There are fears it could undermine the security of bank accounts. More from our economics editor Faisal Islam, who's in Washington, where the IMF is meeting.
One major concern looms over the meetings here, almost as much as the Gulf blockade. A powerful new AI system, not yet released to the public, has already exposed multiple potential security vulnerabilities in some critical financial systems. Mythos has been developed by Anthropic, the company best known for the Claude model. Governments and banks are being offered access to Mythos in advance to help protect their own systems. Canada's finance minister, Philippe-François Champagne, told the BBC it has been discussed at the G7 meeting. C.S. Venkatakrishnan is the chief executive of Barclays.
We have to understand it better, and we have to understand the vulnerabilities that are being exposed and fix them quickly. But this is what the new world is going to be.
The Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey, also told the BBC the model had to be taken very seriously because of the risk of cyber criminals exploiting it. The US Treasury confirmed it had raised the issue with its banks to ready their systems before any public release of Mythos by Anthropic.
That's Faisal Islam in Washington.
Thank you very much for that. It is 8:10. The appointment of Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, to be British ambassador to the United States was hailed by many as a masterstroke. A few weeks after it was announced, the normal vetting procedure was followed by the UK Security Vetting Agency. At that stage, in January 2025, it seems there was a problem. According to the revelation in The Guardian this morning, Lord Mandelson failed the vetting. That at least is the claim. We don't know what the initial vetting really came up with, but he was sent to Washington anyway. What the government says is that Sir Keir Starmer was not told, and nor was the Foreign Secretary at the time, David Lammy. The Foreign Office official who oversaw the whole process was fired, it seems, last night. The problem for Sir Keir is that he repeatedly seemed to suggest that the vetting procedure had been successful. Here he is at a press conference in Hastings in February this year.
There was then, I should add, security vetting carried out independently by the security services, which is an intensive exercise that gave him clearance for the role. And you have to go through that before you take up the post. Clearly, both the due diligence and the security vetting need to be looked at again.
Then at Prime Minister's questions in September, he said three separate times that due process had been followed to make the appointment.
Mr. Speaker, as she and the House would expect, full due process was followed during this appointment, as it is with all ambassadors. Mr. Speaker, as I say, full due process was gone through in relation to this appointment, as would be expected. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I've made clear to the House, a full due process was gone through when the appointment was made.
So, is it really right that no minister knew that the vetting had been failed? Darren Jones is Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister.
That's right, because the process that took place here was that UK security vetting undertook its investigations of Peter Mandelson. This is normal for sensitive appointments and is a deeply personal process where individuals are asked about their personal and financial backgrounds. That advice was then given to the sponsoring department, in this case the Foreign Office. We now know that the security vetting process recommended not to appoint Peter Mandelson, but the Foreign Office had the right and used the right to overrule that recommendation and to give him developed vetted status and to appoint him anyway. And
but it is not credible, is it, that Sir Ollie Robbins, then Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Office, recently appointed to that role, would have taken a decision this momentous to overrule that advice without mentioning it to at least the Foreign Secretary, if not the Prime Minister?
Look, I find this whole situation astonishing as well. When I found out about this yesterday afternoon when I was out campaigning for the local elections in Southampton, I immediately returned to London to be told that not just in the case of Peter Mandelson, but that the Foreign Office and a small number of other organisations have the right to ignore the recommendation of security and vetting officials when appointing people to sensitive roles.
But nobody believes they would have done that.
But they have, they did, and they have. That's why I immediately suspended the right last night for the Foreign Office and other organisations to be able to use that exemption.
Will Ollie Robbins, Sir Ollie Robbins, who's now left his job, be given the opportunity to give his side of the story, to tell us all in public what happened?
I think that's a question probably for the Foreign Affairs Select Committee and whether Sir Ollie gives evidence to Parliament.
Right, but if they ask him to, then he's you as a government are willing for him to give his side of the story.
Well, that's a question for Sir Ollie. It's not a question for me.
Yeah,
well,
if he wants to and if he decides that it's right to do so, the government will not stop him.
The government can't stop people giving evidence to Parliament. Right. That's not how the Constitution works in this country.
So we will know then from him, for instance, what the grounds were that the initial recommendation was that Lord Mandelson was not to be appointed, if indeed that was the recommendation. Because it's not clear, is it, exactly what the recommendation was? Or is it to you?
So the recommendation was to not appoint Peter Mandelson to the role.
Based on what?
Well, I've not seen the documents or the detailed information. As I say, this is deeply personal information about financial, personal backgrounds and particular views and relationships. It's normal for that information to be kept only by the security officials who conduct this work because it is so invasive into people's personal lives.
Would it not also, though, be normal for the Prime Minister, given the sensitivity of all of this and given what he subsequently said on repeated occasions, one of them we've just been listening to have checked that what he was saying was right?
Well, the Prime Minister was told that Peter Mandelson was granted developed vetting status and was therefore appointed to the role.
The fact is then what you're saying this morning is that actually he was lied to by the Foreign Office.
The Foreign Office did not tell the Prime Minister that they granted developed vetting status to Peter Mandelson against the advice of the security and vetting process. The Prime Minister was only made aware of that on Tuesday evening this week when the documents became available to the Cabinet Office as part of the humble address process.
Did any minister ask to see the vetting?
No minister is allowed to see these vetting documents as a matter of principle because we employ security professionals to conduct deeply invasive personal investigations into people's backgrounds and for those officials to then make a recommendation to civil servants on the appointment and the employment of individuals.
Do you accept that Sir Keir Starmer has, and we heard that clip from a press conference, but also crucially in Parliament, has he misled MPs, albeit inadvertently, as you would say?
No, because the Prime Minister was very clear that due process was followed. The fact that due process involved the right for the Foreign Office to ignore the recommendation of the security and vetting team is astonishing,
but it was the established process. Come on, Mr. Jones, you gave a misleading impression. He certainly did at that press conference. And he said to the Commons, I'm quoting now, full due process was followed during this appointment, as it is with all ambassadors. I mean, technically, that's true, but he was giving a misleading impression, wasn't he? Albeit that he didn't know himself. And in those circumstances, he is meant to go back to the Commons and fess up.
I completely refute the suggestion that the Prime Minister's led the public or the House of Commons. It's very clear from his words that he was reporting what he had been told and what process had been followed. No, the fact that the Prime Minister was not told...
You say you refute it. In that public statement in Hastings, he was absolutely clear, wasn't he, that this had happened, that the vetting procedure had been properly done, and that the vetting procedure, because Lord Mandelson had subsequently been appointed and then had to be fired, that actually the vetting procedure itself was at fault. In other words, he said things to us that were misleading. Even if he was misled himself, they were misleading things to say.
They were not, because the nub of the issue, as I've explained to you, is that the process that was allowed to happen until I changed it last night was that the Foreign Office was allowed to overrule the recommendation from UK security vetting in appointing Peter Mandelson and then was not obliged to have to tell ministers about that. The fact that that process was the established process, as I say, was astonishing to me when I was told about this last night, which is why I've stopped it immediately from happening again in the future. But that was the process, and that's why the Prime Minister wasn't misleading the public or the House of Commons in his statement.
What does it say about the way he runs his government?
I don't think this is a question about the Prime Minister's leadership. This is a question...
Really?
No, this is a question
of... he's made statements on a vitally important issue to people that have misled them. Even if he wasn't meaning to mislead them, he has made statements to the effect that one thing is the case when it plainly isn't the case.
No, again, I refute the suggestion of any misleading of the public or the House. What this is a failure of the state. The fact that this process was allowed to happen in the way that it did, where the Foreign Office was allowed to overrule the recommendation of the security and vetting team without having to tell ministers that it had took that decision, that is a failure of state process that was in line with the rules, which I have now changed. But that does not bring into question the Prime Minister's leadership, because he was neither part of that process nor told about it.
This goes to what Kemi Badenoch was telling us just a few moments ago, that actually this guy is a former chief prosecutor. It really does strain credulity to imagine that the state, as you say, could get on with all these things and he's just not involved, not able to get a grip of them. I mean, number one, it's his job to get a grip of them as Prime Minister. But number two, he just seems incredibly incurious about things that are important.
That is not the case, because the developed vetting process, as I say, is a deeply and personal intrusive process. So anybody going through the DV process is interviewed by a security professional. They ask questions about the source of their income, sure, their financial status,
but
their
Sakir
current
could have
and past
asked,
relationships.
Did he pass it or not?
Well, the Foreign Office did pass the developed vetting status in appointing Peter Mandelson.
Yeah, the point is, did they recommend that he passed it? I mean, all of these things, it all sounds very legalistic, very loyal. And I think to most people listening, I mean, it is simply a fact of have you got a grip or have you not got a grip? Are you saying things that are true or things that turn out to be false? And on both of those things, on the grip and on the true and false things, Sakir fails.
I disagree with that. What is true is that the process allowed the Foreign Office to overrule the advice of security and vetting officials in appointing Peter Mandelson without having to tell ministers that it had done so. That is a matter of fact. What happened in this set of circumstances, it is a matter of fact that the Prime Minister was not told about that until Tuesday evening this week. It is a matter of fact that that was the process, that is the due process that was allowed to happen. But I agree with you that the fact that that was the process that was allowed to happen is quite frankly flabbergasting and is something that I stopped immediately as soon as I was informed of this process last night.
What The Guardian has claimed as well is that officials have toyed with the idea, at least, of not revealing all of this to Parliament.
That's not true. All of these documents are going through what's called the humble address process, which my department is responsible for. Right. When Parliament passed the humble address requesting all documents about Peter Mandelson's appointment and then dismissal, we've been working to gather those documents from across government. There are very, very many numbers of documents that have to go through the Metropolitan Police because there is a live criminal investigation, has to go through the Intelligence and Security Committee, and at that point, documents are then published.
And you're
to
happy
Parliament.
For everything, including potentially your messages if you sent them to and from Lord Mandelson when he was ambassador. All of this is going to be before the committee and potentially before the public.
So we've already published one tranche of documents. We will publish the next tranche of documents soon, but it's right that the documents have to go via the Met Police first because of the criminal investigation, and then through the Intelligence and Security Committee, as was the will of the House, before those documents are published.
Sir Keir Starmer is coming to the Commons, isn't he, on Monday. Why did he not go to the House on Wednesday, as Kemi Badenoch was demanding that he should have done, when he knew that things had been said that were potentially misleading? And I take your point, let's put it to one side, that you say it certainly wasn't deliberate and actually there was nothing misleading. Should he not have cleared up all of this on Wednesday?
So as soon as the Prime Minister was informed on Tuesday evening that this had happened, he'd requested the Cabinet Secretary to provide him with a detailed list of the facts. What happened, when, who did what, and how do we explain that this situation
happened
in the
first place?
Why did
he not go to the Commons?
The reason he asked for those facts is because he told the Cabinet Secretary on Tuesday evening that he was going to go to the House of Commons to provide this information to Parliament and to the public. But it is right, therefore, that he had all of those facts in front of him before he did so. Because if he went before he'd had those facts and inadvertently made a mistake, Parliament would rightly criticise the Prime Minister for doing that. So the Prime Minister had intended to bring this to the House as soon as possible. The House is obviously not sitting today because it's Friday, and that's why the Prime Minister will be in the House on Monday.
Darren Jones, thank you very much.
It is 22 minutes past eight now. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Iran. As a fragile ceasefire there continues, delicate negotiations towards an end to the fighting go on in the background, in some way at least. There had been talk of new discussions in Pakistan this weekend, but they haven't been confirmed, and so they may or may not happen. It's yet to be seen. The fact that fighting has now paused in Lebanon, which Iran always wanted to be part of that original ceasefire, that would be viewed as a positive step forward. Now, Lisa's reporting from Tehran on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. Restrictions apply to all international media organisations operating in Tehran. Lise, you are in the Iranian capital, as we said. What have you been seeing and hearing there?
Well, the fragile ceasefire is holding, even though I have to say not a single Iranian we've spoken to in the last 2 days believes it will hold. But so you can feel how some of the rhythms of the city are returning. You can see it in the traffic. You can see how many of the people who fled the worst of the bombing have now come back. A lot of shops and cafes are open. But you can also feel how those weeks of war took a heavy toll. Prices are higher. They were higher even before the war. The near total digital blackout has not been lifted. And it's the security visibly tighter, more forces on the streets in uniform and plain clothes. There's even armored personnel carriers positioned on the main squares. Iranians, whether or not they support the government, were shaken by this war, and they're coming to terms with their losses. Because for all of the targeting of security sites, the assassination of top leaders, civilians were also killed and injured, and civilian infrastructure was also hit. We went to see one site in this city.
We've come to this one narrow street in this leafy, seems to be largely residential neighborhood in the heart of Tehran. And in front of us, a huge gaping hole. Whatever stood here before is completely gone. There's just heaps of concrete and twisted metal. And you can hear the excavator at work and also the workmen carrying away the rubble of this building. Now, there's obviously sensitivity around these sites. We've had to wait more than an hour as security people kept coming up to us asking whether we had permissions to work. Now that we do, let's try to find out what was here before and what happened that day. There's on the other side of the street. The facades have all been blown out by the impact of these attacks. And one man opening this door.
My name is Mehran.
And this is your house?
Yeah, my house. My house.
What's left of it?
Yeah, finished.
Literally walking over chunks of cement. The dust is still rising. Mehran is just showing us what's left of his home here.
It's one month ago, this Trump destroyed for the help for Iranian people. This is now this gift, yeah? A special gift.
Why do you think they attacked here?
I don't know. This all is here for normal life. Woman, children, and normal. Here, not the army. Only for life. More than 25 years I'm here. You see?
You look. Were you here that day?
No. Before, I was 10 minutes ago, I'm here.
Oh, you were 10 minutes away?
Yeah, yes. Oh. I'm here.
You were here and then 10 minutes later it
yes,
happened.
Yes.
But Israel and the United States say they're only attacking military targets. We're hearing the same story from everyone who comes up to us, people who live in another building on this street, people who've known this neighborhood for a long time. They say there were no military people living here. There were no security offices. It's impossible for us to know why this particular building was targeted. But now someone's come up to us. Do you know what happened?
I was there and suddenly we hear explosion and come out from the building and see, wow.
There's nothing left.
Nothing left.
It's there's amazing nothing. You're alive.
We escaped from the building, come to the street, front of our building, and everyone just escaping, everyone, the people crowded, and that was terrifying.
President Trump says he's doing this for the people of Iran, to help the people of Iran. What do you say?
You can see the help of president to our people. Ruined buildings, killed people and children.
There are now negotiations between the United States and Iran. Do you think a deal can be done and it will be good for the people of Iran?
I suppose that diplomacy is better than this you can see here. It's better than war. We should do this diplomacy 1 year ago. If President Trump, if the United States more care about this, but as JCPOA in 2015, we make a deal with United States President Obama, Putin. And 2 years later, 3 years later, President Trump tore everything and gone, left.
You think the ceasefire will hold?
I hope ceasefire will hold if Netanyahu and Israel stood to beat it. But I doubt about it.
We may not have all the information about why this attack happened, but what is clear is that down a whole stretch of this street, people's homes were destroyed, lives were lost. This is just one building on one street in one city, highlighting the cost of this war to civilians and the risks if this fragile ceasefire collapses.
That is Lise Doucette reporting from inside Iran now. In half an hour's time, we will join Kirsty Walk for the reunion.
In the 2003 Iraq War, several hundred volunteer human shields travelled to Baghdad as Iraqis prepared for the shock and awe of an American-led coalition attack. Many of them had got there on double-decker buses from London. The group were ridiculed for their summer holiday romanticism and plagued by rows over the route and ideological splits. One bus was partly decapitated on the German Autobahn, another broke down in Rome, missing out on a papal audience. Arriving 10 days late in Baghdad, there was growing unease. Were they heroes or were they stooges? Five former human shields recall the experience in The Reunion in half an hour.
If you're waiting on tenterhooks for the sport, don't worry, it is coming. Mike is already here, but you're not going to hear it for a minute or two, because first I need to tell you the weather. It's going to be wet. In fact, rain spreading eastwards across much of the UK, leaving only the southeast dry. Later it's going to turn sunny, but cloud and showers in the north.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. And at 8:30, it's time for a summary of the news with Chris Aldridge.
The most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, has left his job after it emerged his department overruled failed security checks to allow Lord Mandelson to be appointed US ambassador. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says Sir Keir Starmer should resign and is deliberately being dishonest about what he knew. But the Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, told this programme Sir Keir had not misled Parliament or the public. Both the Liberal Democrats and Reform UK have questioned the credibility of the government's explanation of what happened. President Trump says Iran has agreed to hand over its enriched uranium. Tehran's nuclear programme is one of the key sticking points in negotiations to bring the war to an end. A 10-day ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon has come into effect. The Iranian-backed group Hezbollah has indicated it will abide by the pause in the fighting. France and the UK are to chair a meeting in Paris aimed at establishing a multinational force to ensure safe passage for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. The US, Iran and Israel won't be involved in the talks.
Thank you for that. 29 minutes to nine. We can keep under abeyance Mike and the sport no longer.
The wait is over.
Wait is over.
Yes, and could it be
40 years of hurt? And stuff.
Yes,
here we go.
Yes, well, there's lots of football chat very aptly around this morning, Justin. Firstly, we are guaranteed an English team in the final of the Europa League because Nottingham Forest and Aston Villa will face each other in the last four after both were victorious in their quarterfinals last night. Meanwhile, Crystal Palace are through to the last four of the Europa Conference League. They will now face Shakhtar Donetsk. Switching to domestic football, and we are at that point of the season where a lot of promotion and relegations are set to be decided. Later this evening, Coventry City will be promoted back to the Premier League for the first time since 2001 if they can get a point away to Blackburn Rovers. Meanwhile, a little bit lower down the pyramid in the National League, the fifth tier of English football, this could be a famous weekend for the Minster men of York City.
Kitchen puts it back. Finger will go. Yes! He does! Malachi with the goal! Discharging on the pitch! City have done it! Right at the death! The late, late show! I cannot believe it! I'm out of breath! Here's everything they have deserved! This York City side never, ever stop! Get in there, City! Take that, Altrincham! That's what you get for your time wasting!
Take that, Altrincham. For me, that is up there with some of the best commentary this season. Props to David Ward there from BBC Radio York. It is a little partisan, but as it should be on local radio, because the closest title race in any of England's top five divisions could come to a head this weekend. York City stand on the brink of promotion back to the Football League for the first time in a decade. And I'm delighted to say York City's manager, Stuart Maynard, joins us live on the programme. Hi, Stuart.
How are we doing? You okay?
Yeah, we're okay. How are you on ahead of what could be, as we say, a defining weekend? This National League title race this season has just grabbed so much attention, hasn't it? Because it has been an incredibly close two-horse race between you guys and Rochdale. Just tell us what needs to happen this weekend for you to get over the line.
Look, we've just got to focus on this weekend. There's two games to go, and everyone knows I'm making a big point that we play Rochdale on the last day of the season. So we've just got to be focused on Yeovil and take care of our own business, and then what happens will happen.
Yeah, so you are at home to Yeovil tomorrow. Rochdale in second, just 2 points behind you, are away to Braintree, and I think you just have to better their result. Is that right?
Yeah, we've just got to better their result tomorrow, but Rochdale have been in such good form as well. Braintree is a tough place to go, but the way that they've been playing and performing, I think that, you know, they'll try and take care of their result, and we've just got to take care of ours, and then it will be the final day of the season.
Now, you were only appointed back in August, weren't you? Four games into this new season. What's gone right for you and this York City side this season?
I think when we come into the building, I think the group have taken all the detail in the way that we want to work on board so fast, because to not have a pre-season to work on all the detail, it's a huge credit to them. And we put an incredible run together of 24 unbeaten, and it put us right in the mix.
And what would promotion back to the Football League mean for the famous old city of York? You must walk around and come across lots of fans of the football club. What would it mean to have their side back in the big time?
Yeah, they're a passionate fan base that really back the team, and home and away, I think pretty much most away games this season, they've sold the away end out and really backed the boys, which has been really impressive and helped us so much. So it means a lot to the club and the city. I think it's 10 seasons that they've not been an EFL football club, so it means a lot.
And just a final brief point, Stuart, what does this season and this title race, which has enthralled so many people, do for the good and the reputation of the National League? It is the fifth tier of English football, but it's had so many eyes on you guys this season, you and Rochdale, because of this fascinating tussle you've had at the top.
I think for two teams to get over 100 points and not both be guaranteed to get promoted, it would be hard to take for one of us. And that's why the campaign's going for three up, two automatically and one through the playoffs. I think it has to get to that stage now. It's a full-time league now, and the standard in it, I think you've just got to look at the teams that get promoted into the EFL. They're all in and around mid-table or competing at the top end of the division pretty much when they get promoted. So the standard's really good in the National League now, and it's a tough league.
Well, we wish you all the best for this weekend and potentially that final game decider against Rochdale next weekend if it doesn't happen tomorrow. Many thanks for joining us. That is Stuart Maynard, the manager of York City. Does a glorious summer await with this son of York? We shall find out in the next few days.
Thank you, Mike. Worth waiting for as well. I'm sure you'll agree.
I would say, well, yes, so the whole of York would certainly agree this
they
morning.
They certainly would. Sure. They would indeed. It is 23 minutes to nine now. Thank you, Mike. Now, Donald Trump's current feud with the Pope is a particularly tricky one, because it's a conflict that risks losing him the support of a large and important slice of his voting base. Christians are not impressed with his position, many of them, particularly when they know that they helped to get him elected. And they see that what he's doing now is somewhat of a deviation from what he promised them on the presidential campaign trail. I've been speaking to John Yep, who is the president of Catholics for Catholics. It's an organisation that advocates faith-based civic engagement. And he says President Trump needs to hold on to their vote.
You really can't get to the White House unless you get that Catholic vote. So it's extremely important, right? So we worked hard. We loved how President Trump stood up for pro-life issues. His promise of securing the border was a big one for us. His promise of accountability and, as it pertains to this subject, the promise of no new stupid wars, as he would call in the Middle East. So those are some of the high points that we as Catholics kind of rallied around to get him into the Oval Office.
And so you must be dismayed now to see him having this ongoing argument with the Pope.
It was a bit of a shocker. I mean, it's even prior to this conflict with the Pope, it was just when he used images of, you know, equating himself to Jesus in a, I guess, half-jokingly manner, you could say. But at the same time, this kind of follows on the Holy Week prayer service that he had at the White House, where he had some of his close pastors who told him, you know, in that service that President Trump, whatever you do, will be blessed by God. And for us as Christians, as Catholics, kind of hearing that, that's like nails on a chalkboard. It's like, no, you know, you're blessed insofar as you follow what God wants you to do, right? So no one has that divine mandate to do whatever they want, right? So it's that, and then you have the Easter Morning Post, which is very vulgar, right? So the most sacred day for Christians around the world, and President Trump's social media team is putting a vulgar rant about going to war with Iran. So a lot of things like that, little things that were out of place and kind of caught our attention, and overwhelming kind of just sadness to see this. And then you shifted over into this ongoing feud with Pope Leo, right? And of all things, too, you know, it's surrounding this war in Iran and Israel's invasion of southern Lebanon, right? So that's kind of what has really got our attention. It's a war that's very unpopular, especially among Catholics. We sense the somewhat immoral nature of this conflict, and we're reacting to it.
What power do you have, John? And by which I mean you personally, you as Catholics, you as an organization, to actually change the president's mind on this? You know, presumably you want to bring him back to the position that attracted you to him in the first place. Is that something you can do, or are you limited to just doing interviews like this, making it clear that you are unhappy with his position?
America has always worked with the power of the people speaking up, you know, and once you elect a candidate, someone for office, you can't just walk away. They need to hear from us. We're doing this also to help President Trump. He ran to make America great, and he needs to know what we, the people, are thinking. And whether it's President Trump, whether it's future politicians, they have to recognize just by the statistics alone that the future of America is Catholic, right? The number of conversions that came in over this past Easter really kind of show that demographic is expanding, and they're going to need to pay attention to what Catholic voices are saying.
I was just wondering, John, I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying there. Do you think that he cares what you think?
I do think President Trump cares. I think he's got a good heart, a very good heart. You know, he's done so much good for so many people, you know, and he does care. I think you kind of see a difference when President Trump in the campaign mode. And yes, he's trying to earn your vote, so he may say everything. But when he's with the people doing rallies every few days with 60,000, 80,000 people, he's hearing directly through their standing ovations or through their applauses. That doesn't really happen as much once you get inside those closed doors of the Oval Office. You're shown, you know, we were shocked. He boasted about a 100% approval rating on a CNN poll. We, who've heard President Trump mock CNN for years, are a little bit beside himself that he's now quoting that as a source of approval for himself.
To be clear, John, when you have these two loyalties, one to President Trump and one to the Pope, if we find ourselves in a situation like the one we're seeing now with conflict between the two, your loyalty will always be not with the president, but with the Pope.
It's the way the Declaration of Independence is set up. It's one nation under God, right? That's how we do it. Our first preference always has got to be to God. Everything else comes second. So it's actually the American way, and that's how it's going to function. I do believe President Trump can change. He's going to hear this voice, and I have hope. We've seen in the 1980s, we had that incredible relationship with President Ronald Reagan and John Paul II. Look what it's able to be done with a church that's working directly with the state. Good things happen as a result.
John Yeap, the president of Catholics for Catholics, thanks for joining us.
18 minutes to nine is the time. We heard on the news yesterday that a very big study, an overall study, suggested that Alzheimer's drugs do not work. They do not slow the disease by enough, basically, to justify their use. It was an enormously distressing piece of work, but also one that has been contentious within the scientific community. Some people saying that they should not have been so clear-cut about it and that actually some of these drugs may still have promise. Let us talk to Professor Tara Spires-Jones, who's group leader at the UK Dementia Research Institute, director of the Centre for Discovery Brain Sciences at the University of Edinburgh, and to Professor Sir John Hardy, who's a neurogeneticist in the field of neurodegenerative diseases. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Professor Hardy, first of all, what do you make of the study, the meta-study that was conducted?
I thought it was seriously flawed, and actually I thought it should never have been published. What they did was they pooled data from drugs which have been discontinued because they didn't work with data from drugs which have worked. So, of course, if you pool data from discontinued drugs with data from drugs which have clearly shown that they do work, then, of course, you come to the conclusion that that overall they don't work well.
Can I just put to you what they say, because that's a really important point, and then we'll go on to your next point as well. But what they say is that they examined all the drugs based on published trial data, whether or not they'd been subsequently approved. So their claim is that they examined everything that needed to be examined. And what you're saying this morning is that that's not right.
Yes, it's not right. These are drugs which have different mechanisms of action. So you're mixing apples and oranges. It's really an incredibly flawed study. I was amazed to see that it was published by Cochrane Reviews. Really, I was really amazed. And I have to say that within the scientific community, my view is absolutely, I think, the standard view among those of us who work on Alzheimer's disease. I'll be interested to hear what Professor Spire-Jones has to
say. Professor Spire-Jones, come in at that moment and tell us, number one, what your overall view is, and number two, what it is that you think, if you do think, that the Cochrane organisation has got wrong.
Yeah, so my overall view is that these anti-amyloid drugs, which are being looked at in this systematic review, have been proven in gold standard phase 3 clinical trials. Two of them, as John mentioned, not all of them, but two of these drugs have been approved and been very carefully examined by regulators like the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA. And they do work. They slow cognitive decline. The problem is they only slow cognitive decline. They don't make you any better. They come with substantial risks and they're expensive. So, of course, there's reasonable debate in the field about whether these drugs are worthwhile in terms of cost-benefit ratio, but they definitely do work. And I agree with Professor Hardy, Professor Sir John Hardy, that this study had some issues. So, that's my overall take home.
But what they say, again, quoting the Cochrane Collaboration, which is the organization, it's a very respectable organization that did this, isn't it? They say no amyloid beta targeting drug demonstrated clinically meaningful benefits compared with a placebo. That sounds pretty damning.
Well, that is a very subjective sort of measure. So the measure for phase 3 clinical trials were set out and very clear, and it was a cognitive measure, so cognitive decline, and also activities of daily living. So do people have a little bit more ability to do things that they want to do day to day? And the two trials that worked did pass phase 3. That's why they've been approved for use in multiple countries around the world. Clinically meaningful is more subjective, and there's not an agreed, as far as I'm aware, we don't have an agreed standard in the field for what clinically meaningful means. The best data I've seen estimate that this small but significant slowing of cognitive decline equates to something like 5 months of preserved cognition before you move to the next stage of dementia. And, you know, that's not a lot in the course of a disease that takes 10 years. But if you're someone living with dementia, that could be incredibly meaningful to maintain some of those abilities.
Well, what does all of this do, Sir John, to the overall hypothesis? The hypothesis that you actually came up with, didn't you? The amyloid cascade hypothesis, as it is called. Where does that stand this morning?
Well, I think it's proven, to be quite honest. Although I would say, and I think this echoes really what Professor Spire-Jones has said, it slows, not stops. So it's a, if you like, a partial proof that the hypothesis has merit. Of course, we want to do more, and I think we will do more. I think we'll do more by getting better amyloid drugs, by getting safer amyloid drugs quite quickly, I suspect, because we now know what we need to do. But we also need to get better at diagnosing it earlier. I think these drugs would work better if we diagnosed it earlier. And of course, we need to find other targets. So I think this proves the amyloid hypothesis. It's the truth, but perhaps not the whole truth. That's my view.
Professor Spire-Jones, what do you think will happen now when it comes to the effort to find drugs that work better? Is this going to be a blow to that effort or not?
I hope not, because the approval of these two anti-amyloid drugs was a real boost for the field, because it's proof of principle that we can at least slow this horrible disease down. And there's so much exciting work going on in the field looking at not just amyloid, but tau, the other protein that clumps in the brain inflammation, all sorts of targets. And we've got real momentum. I've been in the field for 25 years, and it was very depressing for the first decade or two because things kept failing. But now the neurosciences and the sort of genetics and all the science has gotten us to a place where we will be able to make meaningful drugs that will be life-changing for people. I'm confident of this. I can't give you a perfect date because these things take time, but I think it will happen.
So, John, you as confident?
I was actually, I'm going to sound even more confident. I think that every year from now on, we'll have better outcomes. And we'll have better outcomes as we get better at early diagnosis, as we get better at adding other drugs to this cocktail that we're going to need, and as we get better ways of using and monitoring the drugs we now have. I think every year from now on, things are going to get better.
Professor, we've got to leave it there, but thank you so much, Professor Sir John Hardy and Professor Tara Spire-Jones as well.
It is 11 minutes to 9 this morning from 9 on Radio 3 Unwind. Dr. Sian Williams has got you 3 hours of uplifting music from Grace Williams, Jorn Sibelius and Gerald Finzi. Should you seek a small break from the rough and tumble of everyday life?
Talking of that rough and tumble, let us go back to it, 11 minutes to nine, with our political editor, Chris Mason, because we heard, you may have heard, well, we've heard from all the party leaders, haven't we? The party leaders of the Lib Dems and the Conservatives, Kemi Badenoch, just before 8 o'clock, with a very strong set of lines on Keir Starmer, personally saying that he should take responsibility for misleading people, as she put it, over what had happened with Peter Mandelson's vetting. We heard then from Darren Jones, the chief secretary to the prime minister, saying that Keir Starmer is furious that he was kept in the dark. He absolutely rejected, he said, the allegation that there had been any attempt to mislead, or indeed any misleading at all. He's furious with the state, was one line that he had for us. Chris, how's that washing, first of all, with Labour MPs?
Well, I reckon the Prime Minister could do with a splash of Radio 3 Unwind. That would be my conclusion from the last couple of hours. Listening to the interviews that you guys have done this morning, I think the Darren Jones argument of half an hour or so ago that the Prime Minister wasn't misleading because the procedure at the time did allow the Foreign Office to reject vetting advice, saying someone had failed that vetting. Whilst that is true, it seems to me that it's going to be seen as a bit of a stretch that that doesn't amount to being misleading, given that the key fact from the whole vetting process didn't see the light of day until journalists, The Guardian, brought us that news that he, Lord Mandelson, had failed at that vetting process. Now, the Prime Minister will make an argument, I think, come Monday, that it was inadvertent. He wasn't in possession of that fact, therefore he didn't share it at the time. But it does cycle back to the argument that says, well, why not? Why were you not more curious? And as you say, Kemi Badenoch saying to us, all roads lead to a resignation. And she wasn't talking about Sir Ollie Robbins, she was talking about the Prime Minister. And from the Prime Minister's perspective, and from Labour MP's perspective, with big set of elections 2 weeks on Thursday, this is clearly the last thing they need when out in the wild yet again are all of these questions about the Prime Minister's judgment and, yes, the Prime Minister's future. After a little bit of respite in recent weeks from that narrative that has ebbed and flowed at least since Christmas.
It really was striking. In Anna's interview with Kemi Badenoch, she doesn't resile from saying pretty clearly she believes, Kemi Badenoch, that the Prime Minister lied to the House of Commons and lied to the public in that now famous press conference in, I think it was, Hastings.
Yes, and that's despite the fact that at the moment the Prime Minister's argument is, look, I didn't know. So the question is, therefore, is there evidence to substantiate Kemi Badenoch's claim that this was knowing? In other words, it was a lie rather than being misleading. Now, clearly, being misleading is not, is a million miles from ideal from the Prime Minister. The key witness, if you like, in all of this, and you were pushing Darren Jones just about this earlier on, is Sir Ollie Roberts, now departing senior civil servant at the Foreign Office. I suspect he will find himself in front of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee at some point, and I suspect may want to set out publicly his argument about what happened and who was told. The key question, it seems to me now, is who else did know? So we know the Prime Minister says he didn't know, that ministers didn't know. We know via friends that Morgan McSweeney, the former chief of staff in Downing Street, didn't know, that Lord Mandelson didn't know, that David Lammy, the then foreign secretary, didn't know. Now, they're a good number of the key people you would think might have found out. But who else could have found out, which may point to some evidence that burnishes that accusation from Kemi Badenoch? In Kemi Badenoch's argument, she says, look, you know, she's been sitting opposite the Prime Minister when she's been hearing a fair amount of all of this stuff, and makes the case, as I guess many a listener might, which is, well, hang on a minute, whatever has happened here, we have come away with a million miles short of the full picture in lots of these accounts from the Prime Minister.
There was a memory among some of Amber Rudd resigning years ago. I think it was 2018, wasn't it, when she inadvertently misled, and there was no suggestion, actually, she told a lie, but she inadvertently misled a Commons committee. I just think in terms of parliamentary procedure, and Darren Jones was very careful. When I asked him about it, he looked at what the Prime Minister had actually said to the Commons and said, well, look, he didn't say anything that was wrong.
He said he refuted, as he put it, the suggestion that he'd misled. But MPs will be interested, won't they, of all parties, and indeed the Speaker. I mean, it matters a lot, doesn't it, still, if someone goes to the Commons and says something that isn't true and then doesn't immediately go back and correct it.
Absolutely. It'll be the first morning in my life that I quote Chapter 1, Paragraph 1.6c of the Ministerial Code, but it is
twice,
of paramount...
as you've now
twice.
Quoted it.
Exactly. It is of paramount importance that ministers give accurate and truthful information to Parliament, correcting any error at the earliest opportunity. Now, Darren Jones is arguing that it wasn't an error because what the Prime Minister was setting out was the established procedure at the time, including the potential for the Foreign Office to reject advice. But clearly, the key fact wasn't there. As someone put it to me last night, if you arrive at work looking a bit sweaty and tell your colleagues you run to work, but fail to tell them that that's because you were chased there by a bear, the central fact in the conversation has not been mentioned. And that's the accusation, if you like, with a rather frivolous example being levelled at the Prime Minister.
That's a good one. Chris Mason, thank you. And as it's election time, I should reflect on what the other parties are saying. So Reform UK, the Green Party, Plaid Cymru as well, all calling this morning for the Prime Minister to resign, all accusing him of lying about Lord Mandelson's vetting. The SNP, Scottish National as well, writing to the Independent Advisor on Ministerial Standards, Sir Laurie Magnus, calling for an investigation into whether the Prime Minister did deliberately mislead the public.
Let's end the programme then at 4 minutes to nine by spending a bit of time on Arthur Miller, whose work is undergoing something of a renaissance. Two of his plays, Broken Glass and The Price, are on at the West End at the moment. The film version of a recent London production of All My Sons has just been released. There were two versions of The Crucible showing at the same time last year. So what is it about his writing that is speaking to a new audience? Jonathan Mumby's with us, director of The Price, which opens today at the Marylebone Theatre. And Susanna Clapp is the Observer's long-standing theatre critic who's seen and reviewed plenty of Arthur Miller's productions over the years. Good morning to you both. Jonathan, first of all, what was it that made you want to bring The Price to the London stage now?
Well, it's a brilliant play which hasn't been seen in the UK for a while, but I think it's something about Miller and the fact that we need Miller at the moment, especially at the moment, I think, because he helps us make sense of a world that feels morally uncertain. He asks, I suppose, the questions that we want to avoid as a society about responsibility and truth and the cost of the choices that we make. The Price delves really directly into these ideas. It's just a thrill to be bringing it to an audience.
He probes the discomfort, doesn't he?
He does. He feels very contemporary as well. I think the moral dilemmas of his plays haven't gone away. If anything, they've intensified. Miller wrote this play during the Vietnamese War, and here we are again with America at war. And so those questions about duty and about personal responsibility feel really urgent.
Susanna, what do you think? Because as we said, you've seen not just countless adaptations of Miller's work over the years, but lots of new contemporary thoughts on the stage as well. Is it time for us to be going back to what Arthur Miller had to say?
I don't think he's ever really gone away. I mean, I've seen, as you said, many adaptations and many different productions. I think the point is that he expresses the American dream becoming the American nightmare to some extent. Time and again, his themes, which were rooted in his particular day, reverberate today. We've got in The Crucible the beginnings of or echoes of McCarthyism. There's a crushing capitalism adumbrated in Death of a Salesman. In All My Sons, which had this brilliant recent production, there's the lying establishment, the profit motive crushing everything else in its path. And also, I think, interestingly, something which is perhaps less discussed, the difficulty of being a man in a beleaguered world. So, and Broken Glass still on, which has centrally the question, is being Jewish a full-time job? Where he was brought more of his personal life to the stage. So all these things come back with that ability that theatre has to sort of be a parachute from the past into the present.
Yeah, they are timeless themes, aren't they? And it's always interesting to see them through new eyes and being performed by new actors and directed by new directors. Thank you both. Really appreciate it. Susanna Clapp there, the Observer's long-standing theatre critic. And